recording now.
All right. Okay, so I think the question that a number of you guys have on your mind is, what have we been doing? What have we been doing for the past couple of months? If people don't know, there is the beginnings of a website. If you haven't checked out the animations page lately, there is a link for the harmonies. So far, the only link on that that's up is the class that we gave at a cadre school in the DC cadre school out in Maryland a couple of weeks ago. If people haven't listened to that, it's a pretty extensive work through of book three with our patient here, our monochord. We've really got to know our friend the monochord during the course of that class. So if people haven't checked that out, it's up. Know that it's there. Check it out. And you'll get a sense of some of the stuff that we've been doing. But we're going to do something a little bit different tonight to give you guys a sampling of some of the fruits of our labors, which you'll see more of probably over the next couple of weeks. But one point I'd like to make to begin with is that in the course of our discussions, something that stuck out as very interesting was that we were discussing the issue of animating Kepler's work. But in that discussion was taking place in a context of having some idea of Lin's discovery. So that what we're actually doing is that we're engaged in a project where we're using the discovery of Kepler, or the discoveries of Kepler, for the purpose of getting a much more comprehensive sense of what Lyndon LaRouche's discoveries are, particularly because it's necessary at the point of history that we're out at right now, and especially after the webcast that he just gave, it's clear that that's really what we have to do, and we have to replicate the discoveries of LaRouche, which involves replicating the discoveries of many thinkers in the past within ourselves, so that we can go out and help assimilate these ideas into the population and generate a culture around this where we could actually have the next 50 years of actual prosperity to look forward to. So the question comes up is, how do you actually relive a discovery? Do you just read it in a book? You go through the book, you read everything that this person has written, and you get a sense of what their discovery is? I know people have been working on the new astronomy. That's one very unique writing where Kepler actually does take you through a process of a series of hypotheses that he had to go through. But you find that the discovery itself is not in the pages of the book. In fact, you know that the book that he wrote is coming after the fact that he had made the discovery. And the real challenge is figuring out how to grasp that object, that change that occurred in his mind between the time that he first started asking the questions and he actually got to sit down and start writing about what he actually did figure out. And that's sort of a similar, well, it's the same type of process as dealing with a discovery of a physical principle, that you have some object that you see the effects of, just like the books that Kepler wrote are the effects of the discovery that he made, but it's not in the effects, the discovery is not in the effects itself. So the Harmony of the World, is a book that's written a little bit different than the New Astronomy, whereas he doesn't quite take the same approach, but it poses that challenge. And that's one of the things that is particularly getting through book, getting up to book five of The Harmony of the World, is that what confronted us immediately was that what he's writing in the book does not necessarily tell you exactly what he was thinking about, but it gives you, it supplies you with certain clues that you then have to follow up on to conduct an investigation to figure out what actually was going on in Kepler's mind. So, as a, to kind of get into the heart of the matter here, I want to read something which I think is just fun, that, in my own work, before taking up this particular project, in trying to replicate the discoveries of LaRouche, I had been reading through some of the authors that LaRouche was fighting through in his younger days. Namely, this one guy, von Neumann, John von Neumann. And I was reading this very long book, extensive book on the theory of games and economic behavior. And I'm reading through this, and suddenly this passage jumps out at me. So I'm going to read it to you guys. I found this very provocative, as I'm sure LaRouche did too, and I think you guys might as well. So what he says is, the empirical background of economic science is definitely inadequate. Our knowledge of the relevant facts of economics is incomparably smaller than that commanded in physics at the time when the mathematization of that subject was achieved. Indeed, the decisive break which came in physics in the 17th century, specifically in the field of mechanics, was possible only because of previous developments in astronomy. It was backed by several millennia of systematic, scientific, astronomical observation, culminating in an observer of unparalleled caliber, Tycho de Brahe. Nothing of this sort has occurred in economic science. It would have been absurd in physics to expect Kepler and Newton without Tycho, and there is no reason to hope for an easier development in economics. So this is page four of The Theory of Games and Economic Behavior. So, I mean, that just sort of jumped out at me. And I'm thinking to myself as I was reading this, what is he saying? What exactly is he saying? I mean, I read what he said. I know what he said, but what really is he saying? So, this question of creativity, this question of what is it that actually distinguishes Kepler from any of the other guys he mentioned? He just named Tycho, de Brahe, and Newton in this paragraph. But what is it that distinguishes Kepler? And for that matter, if we're going to discuss economics, what is it that distinguishes LaRouche from any of the other guys that are around? So, what Kepler's first writing, I know a number of people have worked through it, was the Mysterium Cosmographicum, which he wrote in, 1596. And he actually came back to this work at the end of his life, closer to the end of his life, rather, 25 years after writing the first edition of it. He added footnotes. He didn't change anything about it. He just added footnotes. And one of the key things that he mentions, I think it's in the introduction to the second edition, is that he didn't want to change anything because all of the seeds, everything that came out of his work from that point on, it was already there in one of the chapters of this little book, the Mysterium Cosmographicum. And the main... You put the first image up. So the purpose of him writing this particular work was to elaborate on a particular discovery that he made concerning the ordering of the spheres, the ordering of the distances of the planets, the proportion of the distances between one another. There's other images I think people are more familiar with, but what you see here is Saturn. The each of these planets have an eccentricity, so these three, the three lines here, the top one would be the apihelial distance, the furthest from the sun. The bottom line there would be the perihelial distance, which is the closest to the sun, and then the middle one is the mean distance. So you have those three distances. The cube is placed within that sphere of Saturn's motion. Then you have Jupiter, the three again. The tetrahedron is then placed between Jupiter and Mars. You have the dodecahedron between Mars and the Earth. It gets really small. You have it on the bottom here. Then between Earth and Venus is the icosahedron. This is Venus here. There, it should be three lines, but because Venus has very small, the distances are so small, so close to one another, it looks like they converge on one line in this image, and then he places the octahedron between Venus and Mercury. So this is what he mainly goes through when he develops in he develops how he comes up with this hypothesis. But towards the end of this book, because there's still some questions that remain unanswered, this gets at one question, that is, what is actually determining how the planets are spaced in the solar system. The question that's still up in the air is, what is the relationship of the time that it takes for the planets to complete their orbital period to the distances? So he begins to grapple with this. Yeah. He begins to grapple with this. This is chapter 20 on what the ratio of the motions to the orbits is. That's really small. I know that's really hard to read. But I wanted to read through this. Does somebody want to come up and read this? Frank?
The whole thing?
Yeah. Well, no, that's fine for now.
So far, the argument by which I think a great deal of strength has been added to the novel hypothesis has run smoothly. It has been shown that the distances of the orbits in the hypothesis of Copernicus use the ratios of the five regular solids. Let us now see whether also, from a second argument drawn from the motions, both the new hypothesis and the Copernican dimensions of the orbits themselves can be verified. And for the ratio of the motions to the distances, a more accurate account can be obtained from Copernicus than from the customary hypotheses. In this affair, during my deduction of the sizes of the orbits, coming very close to the Copernican values from the well-known periodic times of the motions, be gracious, kindly Urania, to this splendid endeavor. Your good name is involved now. First, everybody wants each planet to proceed with a slower motion the further its distance from the center, for nothing is more reasonable. Witness Aristotle, De Caelo, in Book 2, Chapter 10. Then that, quote, the motions of each should be in proportion to the distances, end quote. In that passage, although the philosopher is adducing one line of reasoning which is alien to our scheme, that is, resistance to the influence of the first moving sphere, which is the fastest moving, yet by another line of reasoning, he is now fighting on my side, and by his whole notion against Ptolemy and against himself. For he believes that equality of motion is imparted to all the orbits by their movers. But he takes the pretext for the inequality of the times in which they revolve from the orbits themselves. Thus, each particle of Saturn is indeed as fast moving as the lowest sphere of the moon, by the force of their equal motions. But in fact, as the former occupies a wider space, since it is no swifter than the rest, the result is that it revolves in a longer time. Yet the philosopher could not achieve this rather paltry equality in the tradition of the ancients, because it was necessary for them to attribute equal times of revolution to three planets with unequal orbits, the Sun, Venus, and Mercury. And so they made the superior planet always swifter in its orbit than the inferior. In Copernicus, such a ratio is apparent at first sight, for of the six moving orbits, the narrower one always revolves faster. For Mercury passes round in 3 months, Venus in 8.5 months, the Earth in a year, Mars in 2 years, Jupiter in 12, and Saturn in 30. Indeed, if you compare it with the calculations, making the ratio of the motion of each of the other planets to its sphere the same as the ratio of the motion of Saturn to the circumference of its orbit, or to its distance, for the proportion of circles is always the same as that of their radii, you will discover that there is no room for a simple proportion of that kind. Of that fact, take the following table as evidence.
And the next one? No, you...
That one?
Yeah. Okay, can you guys see that? So this is just the table he's referring to. This is the next page. And what he's doing here is he's taking in the first column... Well, I'll just recap this quickly. But what Aristotle's argument is that all of the planets have to be moving at the same speed. So because the planets are at different distances, they have to travel larger circles. Therefore, they're going to take longer periodic times to get around, but they're traveling at the same speed. So what Kepler actually does is he says, all right, well, let's see. If we made every planet travel at the speed of Saturn, how long would it take for these planets to complete their orbits? And I think the most dramatic one, because people are most familiar with Earth's orbit being 365 and a quarter days, is that if we were traveling the speed of Saturn, it would take 1,174 days. So that doesn't quite work out. And if you look at the other, if you look at the other numbers, they're just as absurd. So then he says, okay, well, let's check out Jupiter. What if we made every planet lower than Jupiter travel at the speed of Jupiter? And in that case, Earth comes out to 843 days. That doesn't work. Okay, how about Mars? We got 452 days for Earth. And so on. So it continues, and it since so then he sets the planets' motions equal to the speed of Earth. The lower planets, they're larger than the numbers that it should be. Venus and then Mercury on its own. So no matter which one you choose, you always end up with larger numbers than what it should be. And some of these things are quite extreme, like three times the size of the orbit. So that's clearly not what's going on. But if you take a step back and really think about what is it that Aristotle is saying, or what his argument is, why should the planets move at the same speed? You know, anybody have any ideas? Why should they move at the same speed? Is there any reason?
Why should they?
Yeah, why should they? Because that's what the argument is, that the planets are moving at the same speed.
Because everything's got to be perfect.
also likes uniformity.
If you take that as your assumption, what physical cause could you come up for that?
God. Didn't he have a model where he used a bunch of spheres, like orbs?
Yeah, right.
That were rolling on top of each other.
I'm pretty sure Ptolemy did that.
Aristotle?
Okay.
And if all the orbs were the same thickness, then that would mean that they would move through the orbs.
Even if they weren't the same thickness, if they were just rolling on top of each other, and they weren't, sliding or something like that, then the surfaces would have to be at the same speed for all these.
Yeah, because it's contiguous.
So, Kepler throws this idea out. Clearly, the evidence just isn't there for it, as he says. It just, if you just do the calculation, you just find out that that doesn't work. So he throws this thing out. And so what I want to do, I want to give a sort of conceptual history of the idea here, taking a look at Kuza. Yeah.
I think there was a part when he was reading, I heard him say that his argument contradicts himself and also but supports him. Where did it support?
No, he says it supports on Kepler.
Oh.
He said he's supporting me and contradicting himself. Yeah. So, you want to go to the next one? I don't want to read the entirety of this Kuza quote. This is taken from the second book of Learned Ignorance, chapter 10, called The Spirit of All Things. You got it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Alright, go back.
Back one?
Yeah.
There you go.
Can you guys see that? It's really hard to see. I'm gonna read this. I'm gonna skip over some parts of this. So here's what Kuza has to say. Says, certain thinkers believed that motion, through which there is union of form and matter, is a spirit, a medium, as it were, between form and matter. They considered it as pervading the firmament, the planets, and things terrestrial. The motion of the planets is as an unrolling of the first motion, and the motion of temporal and terrestrial things is the unrolling of the motion of the planets. Certain causes of coming events are latent in terrestrial things as the produce is latent in the seed. Hence, these thinkers said that the things enfolded in the world soul as in a ball are unfolded and extended through such motion. For the wise thought as if along the following line, a craftsman who wants to chisel a statue in stone and who has in himself the form of the statue as an idea, produces, through certain instruments which he moves, the form of the statue in imitation of the idea. Analogously, they thought the world mind or world soul harbors in itself exemplars of things which, through motion, it unfolds in matter. For through such motion, or spirit, a thing is actually determined toward being such as it is. They said that this uniting spirit proceeds from both possibility and the world soul. For matter has, from its aptitude for perceiving, from receiving form, a certain appetite, just as what is base desires what is good, and privation desires possession. Furthermore, form desires to exist actually, but cannot exist absolutely, since it is not its own being and is not God. Therefore, form descends so that it exists contractedly in possibility. That is, while possibility ascends toward actual existence, form descends, so that it limits and perfects and terminates possibility. And so, from the ascent and descent, motion arises and conjoins the two. This motion is the medium of union of possibility and actuality, since from movable possibility and a formal mover, moving arises as a medium. So you guys should just keep that in mind. Let that resonate for a moment. So the next thing that Kepler does is he actually finds out about Tycho Brahe's observations. And he wants to get in contact with this guy to see, well, let's really put my hypothesis here to the test. Let's see how it plays out. So he gets into contact with Tycho, and in the course of their correspondence, Tycho is working on this problem, and a number of people are working on this problem of Mars, which Kepler gets himself involved in, which you guys, I think, are now working through. He writes about in The New Astronomy. And here, he starts to develop his a real basis for answering this question of what is actually causing the motions of the planets. So I think Chris has some things on that.
Yeah. If you go back to, I guess you guys have worked through The New Astronomy, most of you guys have. There's a particular part of The New Astronomy where he begins to conjecture on what would be, not on so much what is moving in the solar system, but what is the mover. And he's beginning to hypothesize different ideas on what this is. And he begins to discuss this idea of the species, of the power. And he says that power resides within the sun, and that this is akin to the nature of light. Even though it's not light, it's akin to the light, the nature of light. And he says in chapter 33 here, this short section, this is talking about the species. He says, "Since therefore this species of power, exactly as the species of light, to see the optics, cannot be considered as dispersed throughout the intermediate space between the source and the mobile body, but is seen as collected in the body in proportion to the amount of the circumference it occupies. This power or species will therefore not be any geometrical body, but is like a variety of surface, as just as light is." And what he means by that, just as a variety of surface, is you don't see light filling empty space. You see the reflection of light on surfaces. And he equates this idea of the species and the moving power in the sun as reflected in moving bodies. And you can know this through geometry. And he says that even though that the species itself is not a geometrical form, it expresses itself through geometry. So that's pretty interesting. So that's sort of something key you want to keep in mind with what he's trying to do as he progresses later on in his work with the harmonies. Because Kepler's original intention from the beginning, going back to the Mysterium and whatnot, was harmony. And he had to take this a side note for essentially for the commentaries on Mars, because there was just not a sound astronomy out there in order to work with to determine, you know, where do you find harmony in the first place? Because his idea was that, you know, this, of course, is Cusanus' idea that the the universe is knowable, man is created in the image of God, right? So God created this universe in order for us to know it. And his idea is that it exists harmonically. So, and if you read through the Mysterium, he had to take, I mean, no one had had a truly heliocentric system, not even Copernicus, even though his idea was right. The data he was still using for determining that system, it still was based off of geocentric observations, which was the Prutenic tables. It was all still, you know, Earth-based observations. The problem that, and this is something we ran into, interestingly, in working through it, the problem you run into is that the Earth has an eccentricity. If you don't set the Earth into motion, what you end up doing is you end up, in a funny way, you end up projecting the eccentricity onto the other planets of the Earth, depending on how oblique the line of apsides is of the planets. The less oblique the, I think the more of a discrepancy you're going to get, the more oblique the apsides is. It's not going to make that big of a difference, because he makes the case for Saturn. So it's interesting. So he had to have his friend Meslin recalculate all the data and everything and go through. And finally he came out, you know, recalculate the Ptolemaic data into true heliocentric data. And the harmonies of his solid model, it worked fairly well, pretty close. And so then you carry on to what he does with Tycho Brahe, where Tycho Brahe has incredibly accurate measurements, like way more accurate than what Ptolemy did. I mean, he was very sloppy. So Brahe is very, very good in that aspect. But it wasn't in Brahe's data where the solution was. It was in Kepler's mind. Which is, it was just his way of hypothesizing, which is what he does with the new astronomy, which is sort of like a taboo thing back then, because you weren't supposed to mix, physics and astronomy. It was supposed to be mathematics and arithmetic, and you can't know these type of things. They're sort of, you know, it's the gods and like this out there, and you know, we're imperfect. So it's an epistemological standpoint that Kepler's taking here, and so you can see him thinking about what is the mover. Not what is moving, right? He wants to think, what is the cause of these type of things? So this is what he's taking up with Mars. There's one planet in the new astronomy. And he gets that down pretty damn well. So he goes, and he says, okay, so he's asking why there? Why is this, right? And he's looking for causes. And you see he's like the first scientist to actually publish his mistakes. In the new astronomy. So you read one thing, you know, like you go on a college campus. Plato does the same thing in the Republic, right? Yeah. You see him, you go on a college campus and everyone's trying to define the Republic, saying, you know, justice is everyone does what they want to, and it's bullshit because they didn't read the whole thing and the professor told them that, because he'll develop an idea then refute it, right? Yeah. And he'll leave you with a question, right? Which is essentially what Kepler does. He sort of leaves you with that question, right? So it's pretty cool. He was the first scientist to really have the balls to do that, you know. So he's very brave in this sense. So he asked why here. And he keeps asking why. You know, he goes on to all kinds of things, you know, the snowflake and all these types of things. Right? He keeps developing this idea. So in the harmony, he's figuring out, okay, then I looked at one planet. Now I got to look at the relationship of this whole system, the system as a whole, as a bounded process. And, you know, if you were at our last class, you saw the development we had through the knowability of figures. And some of you may have worked at the beginning of the harmonies. We get the knowability of figures and the seven harmonic intervals, and how those are have that relationship to the knowability of figures. And it's pretty interesting because he says that that you perceive harmony naturally. You don't, like, hear something harmonic and then go through this big freaking calculation in your head and say, okay, that was harmonic. Right? It's natural. Right? It's something, it's interesting, right? I mean, you can go through and do the calculations and do the geometry and whatnot, and you can discover geometrically that it's something knowable. So Kepler's saying, okay, well, these harmonies exist on a string, and they exist in music, they exist in figures. Now, do they exist in the heavens? And that's really a huge task he takes up in Book 5. And this is really has a lot to do with what he did in the Mysterium Cosmographicum, where he says, you know, he's hypothesizing his relationship with the whole system with all the solids, right? So when he gets in book five, he discusses, when I got Tycho Brahe's data, my idea about the solids was correct, but it necessarily didn't hold because Brahe had more accurate data, and that sort of threw things a little out of whack. So what he develops is going to be pretty interesting. He says that there's four ways you can compare planets, right, in terms of their distances. You got the, every planetary orbit, you got your closest approach and your furthest approach. And you can compare two planets in these different ways. You can compare them to their closest, both the closest sides or the furthest sides, or a closest and a furthest side, or vice versa, right? Approach to the sun. The receding and approach to the sun.
I'm going to draw that. You want to put it on the chair here?
I got the chair here.
Okay.
So the solids didn't quite help. Is everyone familiar with the platonic solid model, how he arranged it? Somewhat. He took the thicknesses of the spheres as the closest and furthest approaches, and what Michelle was showing earlier with this.
I'll just put it up there. Get the idea.
Each one of those little sections there is just a section of the... You know, you take all the solids, you got the spheres, and you got the thicknesses of the spheres, which he says comes close to the furthest, the closest, and the middle, the mean distance of the planets, right? So he begins in this, in here, saying that, okay, there's ways you can compare these planets, since this didn't work entirely. He comes up with some funny ideas. Let me see that. So he's saying if you have a, it's not very clear, but people see this?
Yeah.
Sort of. So if you have a closest approach here, perihelion of this inner planet here, right? Then you have an aphelion here of the same planet. And then let's say you have a, this is not perihelion, let's just put it on this side for perihelion of the outer planet. And the aphelion of the outer planet. There's four ways you can compare this. You can compare the furthest distance or the closest distances to each other, the furthest distances to each other. That's two. You compare the closest distance of an inner, the furthest distance of the outer, or vice versa, the furthest distance of the inner, right? And the closest distance of the outer. There's four different ways you can compare the distances, which he develops in that sense.
Oh, that's the three lines.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because you got a you got a closest and furthest, and you got a mean, a middle.
So what was it that didn't plot well for him?
Well, with Ptolemy's data, which he had reworked by Meslin, it was pretty close. It didn't actually quite perfectly fit, right? Then when he got Brahe's data and he reworked the data with Brahe's data, that came out to be off. Specifically with Venus and I think it was Venus and Mars. What he ends up doing is he tries to develop that a little bit more by putting I don't know if anyone knows what a stellated dodecahedron looks like. I don't know if you have one.
Hedgehog.
Oh, the one you connect the first or second.
You connect the points, right? If you take all the dodecahedron, you put the just put little hats on them and make some like, little stars.
We make them.
Misbehaving. But it fits between Mars and the mid-sphere of the dodecahedron fits for Venus, between Mars and Venus, which gets pretty close, but it didn't quite work. So he goes through these four ways of comparing the planets, and I'm not going to go through this now because it's still a big question in our minds. But what Kepler ends up doing is he ends up figuring out that the total period of a planet, you start and you have a total period of a planet around the sun, right? That squared is equal to the cube of the mean distance from the sun.
Yeah. Say it again.
I'm just going to write it. The period. The period squared is equal to the mean distance cubed.
Does the period mean the entire orbit, or
the entire orbit?
What's the mean period?
Well, let's see. Like, if you don't take into account this,
the mean distance.
It would be that. Well, in this case, that middle sphere. It's actually, if you look at it in the ellipse
diagram.
You know how to like a. I got it.
Actually, I got an animation of it. You want to see it? I got an animation. Let me show the animation. I can't animate it. Here, Brian, I'll check it out. Check it out.
You mean they're proportional?
Yeah.
Proportional or equal? Not that they're equal.
They actually...
No, they're equal. They're equal.
They come out right on top of it.
And the proportion between the periodic time squared...
Days are equal to distances?
Yeah, if you're taking proportion. Because Kepler developed the sort of the base standard of what we use. If you're using Earth as the unit, if you take a full Earth year, it's a 365 and a quarter days, and you define that as your unit.
As one.
Right, and then you measure
the... Okay, yeah.
Then the mean distance in like 1,000.
Okay.
Then as 1 year is to one mean distance on Earth, right?
Yeah.
So one squared. So it works for all the planets.
It's like a day of distance around the orbit.
What's that?
You mean an angular part of the distance around the orbit.
That's how you can compare it.
If you look, to your question real quick, right? if you're trying to find the mean distance of an ellipse, it'd be from a foci here, which is the sun here, to the quadrant here. That would be the mean distance in your ellipse. Anywhere the foci there.
Which is the arithmetic mean distance.
Right. Could animate that, but anyway. Yeah, well, we don't need to animate it. It's fine. Yeah, it's fine. Okay. So he develops
Wait,
that.
Go
yeah, you do want to talk about that. Yeah,
well, where? Yeah, this is part of the what I guess you would call the intellectual archaeology that we've been trying to do, because he doesn't say what he says in the Harmony of the World is that after 17 years of taking the method of the new astronomy and mapping out the way that he mapped out Mars, taking 17 years and mapping out the entire solar system, mapping out the orbits of all the planets using that same method, it came to him, he says, as if it was, he thought he was dreaming. So that's what he tells you. He tells you, it came to me, it finally came to me. He quotes Virgil and he says, it was as if it was a dream.
I can read the quote. This is what he says. No? Okay. Virgil's going to find it. It's different for every translator. But
no.
So what he gives a little bit of more of a of he in the Epitome of Copernican Astronomy, I think he gives you a little bit more to go by, but I mean ultimately what as I brought up before, he was already asking this question in the Mysterium. He's found a relationship among the distances. Does that correspond in some way to the relationship of the motions of the planets? And we saw off the bat, it's not a direct relationship. So what is actually the relationship between these things? What do you need to take into account? Well, the first thing you would need to take into account is what is actually causing the motions. Which for Aristotle, you can't say anything is causing the motions. They're just moving as if there were gods that are just moving the planets at the same speeds. So in the third part of the New Astronomy, he establishes that the sun must be what's moving the planets. And he develops the idea that the sun is emitting an immaterial species which is moving the planets along. So if the species is moving, then that means the sun must be moving. And now he put this forward before it was actually confirmed that the sun does actually rotate. And he had this as a hypothesis, and later on in his life it was confirmed through the observation of the movement of sunspots that the sun actually does rotate. But he said this must be happening.
And what's interesting, just to interject, is he says that he determines this by the proportionality between the sun and Mercury, and he does this. He says that the sun is to Mercury as the Earth is to the Moon. So by determining the proportion of the Earth's rotation to the moon's revolution, in looking at Mercury's revolution around the sun, he's able to determine that the sun spins, I think, at least once in a third of a year, at least.
They're varying speeds.
Well, that's true, yeah, that's true. The equators spin faster than the poles do.
Why is it that he says it's necessary for the sun to be spinning in order for the whole thing to work?
Because if the physical cause of the motion is this immaterial species that he compares to light, what we call gravity, if that's moving, it would be necessary. You have to say that the source of it is moving as well, the source of what's actually emitting this species has to be moving for the whole thing to move. But then that also brings up another question which he raises, that if this immaterial species is moving, why aren't the planets moving just as fast as it is? So now the question is a little bit different. You're back to this question of what is actually being moved. Are these immaterial spots in the sky? They're weightless spots that just would move at an infinite speed if this species was moving at an infinite speed? Or is there something actually material? What are these bodies that are so far away you can't touch them? What are they actually made out of? So now he's starting to hypothesize about the nature of the bodies themselves. And he puts forward the hypothesis that it must be something about the bodies. And he develops his whole theory of gravitation around some of his speculations as to how these bodies are actually composed. So he's thinking through what is the universe actually composed out of? These things that are so far away you can touch, you can't touch, you can barely see them. Right? So he says that they have to have some sort of resistance. And he uses the term, he calls it adunamis,
Or what?
Actually,
I guess what Leibniz
powerlessness.
Yeah, the vis in situs, which is I guess he says in chapter 38 in astronomy. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's actually a resistance of this planet to move, which is at war with the species that is moving it. And they both win in different ways, and you have it played out differently with the various planets, so that there's actually a number of factors that are going into the periodic time. One is the power of the species, which he compares to light. He also compares it to a lever and a fulcrum. When he develops this whole idea of the power being in inverse proportion to the distances. So that's one thing, is that the power of the species at the distance that the planet's at, and then the planet itself. How big is the planet? How dense is the planet? And he's already hypothesizing that as you go further out away from the sun, the planets become less dense. Although they might appear bigger, they might look bigger, they're less dense. And putting all of these things together, he develops the idea that the relationship between the periodic times and the distances is this relationship that Chris just went through. That the proportion between the periodic times squared is equal to the proportion of the distances cubed. But the other thing I would raise here is in the context of discussing this in the New Astronomy, he realizes that you have to be dealing with elliptical orbits, that they're not circular orbits, that the planet is not staying at one particular distance from the sun, but it's actually changing its distance from the sun. But that still, it still leaves another question unanswered, because not all ellipses are similar to one another. You have another variable that is thrown in here. And the question then is, why are there certain ellipses for the particular planets? Why not others? What is the reason for there to be particular ellipses of particular eccentricity for the planets? What does that actually give the universe the freedom to express? And that's precisely the question that he's tackling in the whole of the harmonies, the harmony of the world. And he spends the first four books giving you the tools that you need to be able to tackle that question, the causes of the eccentricities, in the fifth book. You want to go through the table?
Yeah. Well, the funny thing about it being the harmony of the world is that he goes through the whole world. You know, everything. Even like in book four, I think he was it on the political digression and the three means. He talks about how people could harmonically sit at dinner. Frank's nodding. But he's saying, okay, these things are apparent everywhere. He does. I mean, he really lays. He investigated everything from the volumes of irregular containers to, you know, snowflakes to, you know, crystals. He laid the, you know, astronomy, music. He essentially developed the entire history of Western music in the harmonies of the world. He just establishes the basis for it. It's pretty cool. It's So, but what he emphasizes with this is that, like Michelle is saying, that the universe is in motion, and what he constantly emphasizes is that it exists not in being, but in becoming. It's always becoming. So he says. So he goes through in book five, in the beginning of book five, a different approach. And where? Okay, if harmony does exist, if it exists all over the world, where does it exist in the planets? Where do you find it? It's not. And he says the planets aren't like they don't make a sound. You can't. hear the planets, right? They don't make a whistling sound because they don't have a friction. Oh, you know, they don't do that. It's kind of weird, you know. Because it would mostly be dissonant most of the time. Yeah, he says at the beginning of the world, everything was a harmony, everything was set in motion, and then from there, you know. So he so right, so it's pretty funny, but so he's asking, where is this harmony found? And he tried many different methods of approach. First, he tried the solids. He got the new data. He tried the echinus, the hedgehog. Stick it in there. It didn't quite work. He tried the distances, which kind of worked. And he came up with some interesting stuff here. Let me show you. Where is it? I'll do it again. Sorry. I'll show you his table, what he comes up with. Because he this would be cool. Yeah. Okay, these are distances of the harmonic intervals.
These are hard, it's hard to see, huh? It's really hard to see.
Can you zoom
in? No.
Can
you make that bigger?
Wait, what are you saying, Ben?
Just pointed things
if you want us to look at it. Oh, okay. Well, you don't have to go through the whole table. I mean, you could, it's on,
Yeah, I can explain what's what here. This is, for each planet, he's got, Saturn, Jupiter, Mars, Earth, Venus, and Mercury. Right. And for each one, he's got the distance at aphelion, the distance. Oh, this is the apparent motions. Did you want the distances?
Let me see.
This is the.
These are motions. No. Okay, wait. Those are. That's what I wanted.
This is the distances.
That's fine. Yeah.
These are the distance of Saturn at aphelion, its furthest distance from the sun. Saturn at perihelion, its closest distance from the sun. Jupiter, aphelion, perihelion, all the way down. And then over here, what he's doing is he's comparing the ratio of these numbers, the proportion of these numbers to each other, the aphelial and perihelial distance. And then on the other side, the divergent refers to the aphelion of Saturn, and the perihelion of Jupiter compared with each other, and the convergent is the perihelion of Saturn and the aphelion of Jupiter compared to one another. So he's got the divergent and convergent proportions of each of the pairs of planets, as well as the distances amongst to one another.
Is it clear what divergent and convergent is, or?
It's,
Okay, I thought, all right. Okay, good. All right, okay. So, all right, so pretty much, like, there's the idea, right, like that pretty much living processes can now come from non-living processes, right? Now, if that's true, what if, like, pretty much the universe, you're simply just dealing with motion, and that, you know, and pretty much that life is motion, and that it is change.
Yeah, I'm moving.
What do you think
about that? I'm moving. I don't know. It's interesting.
But if that's, you know, basis, you know, of life, is that motion and change, you know, I mean,
yeah. You know, sure. I mean, it's.
Yeah. Can you hold on to that question until the end of the presentation? Because we have a lot of territory to cover, and I think if you keep coming back to that question, it'll develop in a certain way.
Just real quick, when he's comparing divergent and convergent, when he's talking about, for instance, convergent. He's talking about if you have an interplanetary orbit and an outer planet orbit, right? If you compare the aphelial distance of the inner planet, the furthest distance from the sun of the inner planet, to the closest distance to the sun of the outer planet, meaning like if the inner planet is far away and the outer planet is close as possible, then that's a convergent motion, right? The divergent motion is when the inner planet is as close as possible at the perihelion, and the outer planet is far away as possible, meaning that there the inner planet is close, the outer planet is far away. We got really close to an actual convergent motion with Mars in 2003. People remember that. Remember how often does it happen? It hadn't happened in, like, I think 70,000 years.
Whoa!
Yeah. But it rarely occurs that planets actually hit that together. But if you take the whole planetary orbit and you take that distance and you take the other distance, you know, you can compare them, right? So almost, I guess Earth and Mars almost sang a harmony at that point, huh? Anyway, but you can tell what they would do distance-wise. Now you can, if you want to... What he's doing, though, is he's looking at proportions of these distances, measured in Earth units. He's comparing, because it's hard to see, but if you look at page 420 of the harmonies, he gives you the distances at aphelion of Saturn, the distance of perihelion, and he labels them A and B. Right, and then he gives you the aphelial distance of Jupiter and the perihelial distance of Jupiter at C, I guess C and D, yeah. And he compares them, divergent and convergent, and you get certain proportions which come out to musical harmonies. They're close. They're not quite right on. So he's getting somewhere.
You said they're close, but they're not right on.
Yeah. They're not quite on. They're very close. Some of them make harmony. Like Jupiter and Mars make harmony with the distance. Okay. So, I mean...
Comparing the planets' individual distances from the sun.
Yeah. Their maximum and their closest distance. Yeah.
What's divergent again?
Divergent is when the outer planet is at its furthest point and the inner planet is at its closest point. If you were to actually put them on a line, they'd be as far apart as possible.
Oh, okay.
Convergence is when the inner is furthest away from the sun, the outer is closest to the sun.
Okay.
There's a really close space on them.
So they're both, so one's at the aphelion.
Mm-hmm.
And one is the perihelion.
Right.
Okay.
What's the significance?
Well, because he's looking at the motions, and he's saying, well, you have this whole continuous motion, but what you do have the continuous motion bounded by is the extremes. So he's looking at the extreme motions in this case. Or the extreme distances, I'm sorry, not the motions. That's what he develops after he looks at the distances. He says, well, we can't look at this in terms of just distances because these things are moving.
But then he says, these distances, insofar as they are lengths without motion, are not appropriate to be examined for harmonies, because the harmonies are more intimately connected with motion on account of its swiftness and slowness.
So this is where it gets really interesting. This is like sort of where we are. This is where it gets interesting. Because he says, okay, if you want to determine the harmonies, you got to look at the motion, right? But where are you looking at the motion from? And he tries to examine the, what he calls the true daily arcs, which is the arc that a planet sweeps out from the center of its circle in a day.
Or the actual length of the arc.
The actual length of the arc?
Yeah.
Yeah. And he compares that too, I think, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And that doesn't quite work. So he actually does something pretty interesting. He goes back to this idea of how harmony is perceived. Because if you hear a harmonic interval, you don't, like I said in the beginning, you don't like hear it, then you have to like, wait, was that harmonic? And then do this huge calculation to figure out if it was harmonic or not. You sort of recognize it. Your ears, your senses recognize it. He says there's two places where you recognize harmony. One is in light, and the other is in sound. So, and then, I don't know what's that poem with which the unheard melodies are sweeter still?
And
Heat. Lord of the Grecian Urn, yeah.
Unheard melodies are sweet, unheard. Go ahead.
Right. Yeah, yeah. But it's interesting is that what he's finding these and he's finding unheard melodies which are super still, right?
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by light?
He talks about it in terms, I think, of aspects, like the way your eyes perceive. He develops this from what he begins to develop this idea is, he says that the harmonies have to be perceived from the mover. So in a sense, he goes to this whole thing about eliminating what he calls the fantasy of retrograde. This whole thing in the new astronomy is like retrograde. Yeah. Now he's saying eliminate the fantasy of retrograde. You have to put yourself on the sun. But that was necessary. It was a necessary thing for him to get, to be able to put you on the sun, right? And be able to perceive it with what you see. So you're not taking the actual true arc that the planet is traveling along its eccentric. But what you're taking is arc lengths which your eye perceives from the sun. Y'all didn't hear about Bush's space program, did you?
No, we didn't, Chris. What is it?
He said, by the end of the decade, we're going to put a man on the sun.
Did he volunteer?
No,
I don't
want to do that. We're going to do it at night, because it's cooler. I don't think we can go there yet, but we can go there in our imaginations, which is what he's doing there, right? So he begins to perceive.
So real quick, this idea of light, does he mean light in like a sense of like rays of light, or does he mean light as in visible objects?
I think he means in this case, he means it in terms of how do you perceive an object from the sun. Because you perceive arc lengths from the sun, right? And, for instance, you perceive things at, you know, different... And what he says, the way you determine the actual distance of a planet from viewing it from the sun, you have to multiply the daily arc length by the inverse of the distance squared. And that gives you an actual arc length traveled on the by the planet. That's from the sun. So, which is interesting because light behaves the same... an opposite way, I think, right? Yeah, if you increase arithmetically from a source of light, the actual area swept that is or created is geometrically proportioned to the arithmetic increases. The eye is the opposite, so he does this thing where you... Anyway, so there he actually begins to say, well, what can I find here? It's pretty simple, huh? Took a long time to get there, but it's pretty simple. So he comes up to this, right, where he's comparing the motions. And keep in mind... This is really messed up. This guy who translated this book is an asshole. He's a real asshole.
Is that Donovan?
No. I don't know who the guy is. He's a jerk. He is because he... Look. How can you mix up Mercury and Mars? He mixed up Mercury and Mars. This is just one example of what we're going to have to correct in this book. We're going to be using it.
That's right.
You see that the progression, Saturn, Jupiter, Mercury, Earth, Venus, and Mars, right? You gotta switch. The data and the name.
Oh, yeah, that's right. The numbers he has for Venus in this chart are wrong.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, for Mercury. The names of Mars and Mercury are switched, and then the number he has for Mars is incorrect as well.
That's gonna hold on.
We had to work through it, unlike the translator.
Who's that?
Well, his footnotes are saying to
you. Yes. He's like, I can't believe he would talk about intention. There's a force. Just mathematics. Okay. Does this all this algebraic?
How many different English translations are there?
There's only two that I know. There's three, huh?
There's
another one that's the same thing.
There's only one whole book. And then there's two different translations of book five.
Of course, it's the British.
Okay.
Can you still have translations in Aspen? Yeah. We're gonna get the. Okay. So what he comes up with to wrap this up, this part here, we got more to come. Sorry. But he comes up with by comparing the motions, he comes up with very close intervals, which are pretty incredible. You're comparing daily arc lengths from as viewed from the sun, which Lynn was saying this is sort of the beginning of the infinitesimal, which we're yet to produce that for you guys. So. But if you come up with these, you got over here, these are the harmonies produced by the planets themselves, meaning the same planet from its furthest and closest distance, you get a certain proportion. You get this with Saturn, you get the major third. Jupiter, you get a minor third. Mercury, a diapense.
And the fifth.
Fifth. Earth, you get a semitone. It says, mi, fa, mi. And with Venus, you get a diesis, which is very small.
On Earth being a semitone, he says that's important because that gives you the ability to have a major, both major and minor.
Yeah.
That's what he says in the epitome.
Yeah. But then he compares their diverging, converging motions. And he does it on this side. You get these harmonies here, right? Which he says come very close.
Almost perfect.
Almost perfect. Almost. Problem is, it's riddled with commas. So.
And the moon also has a harmony.
The moon produces a diatessaron,
which is the fourth.
And he says, to say, there's a great distance between Jupiter and Mars that he can't account for in the motions, but only in the distances. She sort of leaves that question open. So.
Can you explain what, like, the numerator and the denominator of those ratios are again?
Yeah. It's just the divergence is the divergence is the furthest distance of the outer planet. Compared to the closest distance of the inner planet. So the aphelion of Saturn and the perihelion of Jupiter is the divergent, and that's in the ratio of about 1 to 3. The convergent is this next one over, is the closest distance of the of the outer planet the furthest distance of the inner planet, okay. Which comes to about 1 to 2. Comes actually perfectly 1 to 2.
There it is.
In this, according to the data, it comes perfectly to 1 to 2. So on the left here, you have the comparison between the planets, whereas on the right, This is the comparison for a particular planet at its furthest and closest distance to the sun. It's just taking the direct ratio between them.
There are no ratios that didn't work out whatsoever for any harmony?
What?
There are no ratios that didn't work out for any harmony when you divided the numerator by the denominator.
Okay. Megan's gonna go.
Vinny's gonna get more into ratios and harmony.
Maybe so.
This is Vinny's area.
You gotta rob the audience.
The smart people are actually announcing it. Otherwise, it'd be boring, right? Is it true? You know, I mean, there exists.
What's three? It's called a digression on the 3D.
You guys work so
hard. How did that little
we had to figure out how to arrange our chairs.
All right, where do I begin?
somewhere.
Well, okay. Unfortunately, we can't get into the monochord in depth tonight. There's a class that that we put on at the last cadre school a couple of weeks ago that I also recommend you work through the harmonies yourself. But I have up here a chart which has not all of them, but some of the consonances and some of these parts of the string that produce these certain sounds. That's one half of the string up to the whole. I don't have the other half there, so because it's kind of hard. I just constructed it.
Oh.
It's based on this. You have an entire string, right? And it's tightened, and it produces a sound like that. Now, that's important because, you know, if I didn't play that and I just plucked this, you know, what's that in reference to? Say it's 5/8. Well, 5/8 of what? 5/8 of the whole. So that's important. Because you're dealing with relationships here, not just static objects. So the greatest interval, though, that you create is from a whole to the half. Right. You guys sing that? Sing this one. Okay, now this is the next one, 3/5. That's the whole. This is 3/5. Okay, whole, now 5/8. Now 2/3. Quarters. No. 4/5. No. 5/6. No. 8/9. No. 128/135. So, where you actually get that? That's an interesting thing to point out. Is this 128/135? Because first of all, where do you get it? Are you going to divide your string into 135 parts and then take 128 of them? No. What you do is, for example, between 5/6 and 4/5, right? 4/5 is a certain length, and 5/6 is a certain length. But from the whole, there's only about that much difference. But what is that difference? And if you know, mathematically, if you want to figure it out, 5/6 has a denominator of 6, 4/5 has a denominator of 5, right? So they share a common denominator of, say, a multiple of each other, which is 30. Okay. So what is 4/5 in terms of 30? 24/30, right? What's 5/6 in terms of 30? 25, right? So that's where the ratio comes from. That's called a diesis. It's 24/25. So 4/5 is to 5/6 as 24 is to 25. Right? And likewise for 3/4 and 4/5. The difference between them, 3/4 is to 4/5 as 15 is to 16. So what this is what Kepler does in Book 3 is he develops these different intervals that you start out with, the harmonic ones. And then from the harmonic ones, you find relationships between them, which are called melodic. And then from those, you can find third intervals. Right? So, now this is important because what you were bringing up, this term of motion, is because the string, what we're going to point out tonight are the ontological questions here. And I mentioned this before, and Bruce has brought it up a number of times. Ontological questions like, for example, this is a straight line. It's a monochord, right? It's just a straight line. But there's anything, is there anything about this line physically that will tell you that at this point will produce a certain that certain tone? Right? There's nothing physical about that. You can't just see it with your eyes and see, oh, that's a half is going to produce the same exact note as the whole, except higher. You don't see that physically. But you can hear it, right? So, and what Chris was bringing up earlier on this question of the geometry. In physical geometry, you've got the same problem. Is you've got certain paradoxes which are being brought to your senses, but the mind will wrestle with these paradoxes, which is a very natural thing. Here, this is part of what Kepler talks about in Book 3. You've got a chord of a circle, which is in red. Can you turn off his lights? Is that clear? You have a chord of the circle in red, and you have the arc of the circle subtended by that chord in green. Now, if you notice that the length of the green arc at the top left one, the length of the green arc to the red chord, there's really not much different in length, is there? Like if you were to take that green cord and uncircle it, straighten it out, and then compare it to the red cord, there probably wouldn't be that much difference. And if the angle was even smaller, you'd probably, you know, do it. You'd see it's very difficult. But as the thing starts to move, you see that this arc really starts to grow faster than this cord. And by the time it gets to 180 degrees, you're talking about half the circle corresponding to that chord. Your chord becomes the diameter, in a sense, right? So, in Book 1 of the Harmonies, Kepler talks about the construction of certain polygons and how they're knowable, right? And this is what you're dealing with here, right? A chord subtending inside of a circle, subtending a certain arc, is, in a sense, is a division of the circle. And the whole question that Kepler puts on the table is this question of knowability and also expressibility, right? Certain magnitudes are expressible to each other. They're harmonic. You can find a ratio between one and the other. You know, this one is double that one. Exactly. But there's others where that doesn't quite work out. And he develops different degrees of knowability. But then in Book 3, he makes the point. He says, when I say chord now, I'm not talking about the chord of the circle. I'm talking about this thing. And the divisions you're hearing, constructively, are the arcs of the circle. Not the other way around. Not the actual chord that's dividing the circle. It's the circle. So if I were to have a big circle and I... whose circumference was equal to the length of the chord, and it was divided into four parts, and I rolled it, it would divide the chord into four equal parts. What? I'm sorry, what did you say? This chord, Kepler says, is different than this chord. Because if I were to take this circle and roll it on the string, if this was, say, divided into four equal parts, then it would divide the string into four equal parts. So in a sense, what you're doing is, if this circle was divided into four equal parts, the chord would be dividing the circle into four equal arcs. But the circle, when it's rolled, will divide the string into four equal parts. So in a sense, you're taking the circle and you're unraveling it. That's what you're hearing, right? See, but this brings up the question of commensurability, what I was just talking about, is how you measure one against the other, because you cannot measure this red chord against the green one. You may approximate it numerically, but there's no common measure. It's incommensurable. Yeah, you can constructively take the circle and uncircle it, right? And then compare and contrast.
Why is that important?
You're going to see. So, this brings up a question of the elliptical orbit. Because first of all, in a circle, there's certain... this action right here, which is constant rotation around the circle and a sign that it's dropped onto the diameter. Now, if the point on the circle is moving constantly, then the point at which that projection of the sign onto the diameter is hitting on the diameter, that point will be moving non-uniformly. See, it has to speed up and slow down to catch up with the point on the circle, right? So that's one example of two different motions that are incommensurable. Right? And the sign is incommensurable to the arc that is attended by it, right?
Incommensurable?
This length cannot be cannot measure with an arc. Right? I can't say that if this grows 1, 2, 3, that necessarily the arcs will be in 1, 2, 3.
For
equal,
a list,
right?
For
a circle. Like this, as this thing's growing, it's growing non-uniformly to the arc of the circle. There's no common measure. And likewise for the ellipse. But the ellipse has something special to it. In this diagram, here's the ellipse on the inside and the circle that's circumscribing it, right? These green radii of the circle are all equal arcs. Now on the one side, I have the green lines that are representing the signs of the circle, but the red ones are representing the signs of the ellipse. This plumb bob action drop, perpendicular to the diameter. That's the sign. Right here. Right. But if you notice, the incommensurability on the circle is the sine to the arc. However, equal angles correspond to equal arcs on the circle. Right? But on the ellipse, look at these arcs. Compared with these equal angles. You notice these arcs are getting smaller, and then they grow back. So, this is kind of a shadow of a double incommensurability. Whereas, not only do you have the sign incommensurable to the arc,
but not even these equal angles will correspond to equal angles of the curve.
What do you mean for that
again? Yeah. In the circle, the sine is incommensurable to the arc. However, equal arc, equal angles, correspond to equal arcs on the circle, right?
Like the 90-degree angle will divide the circle into 1/4, right? And four of those will complete the circle.
But on the ellipse, not only is the sine not measurable to the arc, but the equal angles don't even correspond to equal arcs. The arc is constantly changing.
So you're saying the sine and the angles are incommensurable to the arcs on the
ellipse? Yeah.
The sine and the angles.
Yeah.
So now we're going to revisit the question of the doubling of an area and doubling of a volume. Because Kepler doesn't really talk about volumes that much. He has, there's a few sentences in the harmonies where he mentions it, but does not have a full investigation of it. And I'm going to present to you guys something that I investigated myself and took up, and some interesting things that came out of that. But this brings up the question of, again, this question of incommensurability. To go from an area of 1 to an area of 2, a square whose area is 2, what did that length have to be, right? How do you find it? How do you construct it? And that's one question. But an even higher question is, well, what about volume? By the cube of volume 1, how do I get to a cube of volume 2? How would I find that edge of that figure? Right? And Archytas who was a collaborator of Plato's, what first you can look at, yeah, I'm just kind of brushing over a little bit what P is doing is moving along the circle, and it's dropping PQ down onto the diameter. This creates an action. This creates a potential for what's called one mean between two extremes. So, in other words, OQ is the QP as QP is the QA. That's what's happening at every moment on this circle. Creating a proportion that OQ is the QP as QP is the QA. So if OQ was, say, 1, and QP, or QA was, say, 3, QP would be a magnitude which would be not measurable to OQ nor QA. Right? If this was 1 and this was 3, then this would be the square root of 3. And this question of square roots comes up as an old Greek problem, because there's no measure for these so-called rational numbers like 1, 2, 3, 4, and to infinity, and these square root numbers. So what Archytas does is he takes up the challenge and figures it out. This is the question of the square. He tackled the question of the cube. And what he did was,
you've got one circle that's flat, say on a plane, on a table. The other one is upright, 90 degrees from it, and it's rotating around the same pivot point right there. Now, is the diameter of the red circle OA? As OA is moving, it's going to be intersecting the purple circle at a very specific point. And you can see P has to rise and really speed up as it gets right there.
So, Bruce, as Bruce has pointed out before, this is important because this also expresses double incommensurability. Why? Because in your first diagram, Q was just moving along a straight line. P was moving along the circle, as it's doing here, but Q was non-uniform to P. If P was moving, remember the circle one, as P is moving constantly, Q has to speed up and slow down, or vice versa. But now, not only is Q moving along a straight line, but it's moving on this, on the purple circle, in the circular arc. And now, not only is P moving along a circular arc, but it's moving on a whole different curve, which is created by the intersection of a torus and a cylinder. That's just the torus. But if you imagine a cylinder coming out of the purple one, right?
Yeah, it's a very strange curve. I recommend you try to build it.
Or throw a frisbee.
Yeah.
It makes a curve.
So P is moving. So both points now, whereas before, with the one mean between two extremes, which were moving non-uniform to each other, now you've got a doubly connected action that's going on between the two circular rotations, where P is traveling on two different curves and Q is traveling on not only a straight line, but a circular arc. Right? It's funny. Right? Well, it's hard to see from this, but if just sit down with two semicircles and actually, you know, make the other one move across it, and you'll see why. You'll see what P is drawing out, because if you notice the diameter of the red circle, right, it starts out moving like that. But where's P going to be? P's going to be perpendicular off of the circle and hitting this circular arc, the red one, right? Here, here, here. And then it shrinks back to nothing, back when it does a 90-degree rotation. So the relationship of the diameter to where it's intersecting the purple circle has everything to do with where P is going to be.
And you'll see, you'll take different angles and erect a P motion, and it'll just be, at that motion, it'll just be completely, like halfway 45 degrees won't be halfway up off the plane. It doesn't work that way. It's non-uniform.
Just a curious question. If you go back to the other diagram you had before.
With just the two circles?
No, the circle and the ellipse. If, for example, just play devil's advocate for a few minutes, and suppose that the circle is the space that Aristotle talks about, and so the intention of the planet is really moving in a sort of a circle. And the shadow that you see as an ellipse is moving in an ellipse. Would that be something that... What do you think about that?
I'm not sure what you're saying.
In other words, if...
That question may actually be resolved, because we're going to get into that.
Okay.
but I got to plow ahead because the specifics we can get into later, but right now I have to rush and get to a point. So. Okay, so if you haven't discovered, the cube actually happens to be a part of a family. Right? So Kepler, in book two, Kepler brings up the point that, all right, the Greeks knew about these things, right? Five regular platonic solids, right? What makes them regular? They're all equal edged, or if you map them on a sphere, they're all equal arced. Right, all these are equal. They're all equal angles at which they intersect, and they're all the same face. Like in the case of a cube, they're all squares. In the case of this, they're all pentagons. Dodecahedron, right? So in book two, Kepler elaborates a little bit more on what other congruences can you create? Because these are obviously the most perfect that you can make, this type of congruence, where all the edges and angles and faces are equal. So then he gets into the question of congruence. I know these colors are kind of trippy, but just focus on the shapes.
You went back to the 60s. Never
mind, the surfaces are way more trippy.
So this is... Kepler actually discovered... he discovered... We'll probably rediscover this one. It's called a snub dodecahedron. It's got, at every vertex, if you notice, a pentagon and four triangles.
Right.
And this one's a snub cube.
Oh, cool.
Rihanna and myself and a few others have taken a lot of time in trying to figure out where these things exist in terms of where what they are in the platonic solids, right? Because the ones we're going to look at tonight are these top five right here, which belong to the octahedron and cube family, right? And these guys belong to the icosahedron and dodecahedron. This is the only one from the tetrahedron. He's only got one Archimedean. But what makes them so special? What makes them so special is because they exhaust your possibilities of creating congruences on the sphere. And Kepler makes that point, is that he very rigorously goes through, okay, three pentagons fit to make a dodecahedron, but four won't. You cannot fit four pentagons together. The nature of their angles will not let you. So then he goes through, all right, well, how many combinations can we make? And he discovers these, rediscovers, they're called Archimedean, but I don't think we have any writings by Archimedes. They might have been lost. So then the question I asked was, well, where do these things exist in terms of the platonic solids? So one interesting question that brings up that is brought up one thing to point out here is that just before we get into their family, the cube and the octahedron are duals of themselves, which means if you take the midpoints of all the faces of these triangles in the octahedron, you'll get the vertices of the cube. If you take the midpoints of all the faces of the squares in the cube, you'll get the vertices of the octahedron. And that raises a lot more questions. So, now another interesting thing about them is that when you take the midpoints of their edges, so right here is the halfway point of the entire edge, and likewise for the other one. And you connect them on each of their faces, like you do over there, you get the same thing. You get what's called the cube octahedron. Now, in the cube octahedron,
if you take the midpoints of each edge of the cube and you connect them, you will generate inside of the cube a new solid, and it's called the cube octahedron. If you do it to the octahedron, you get the same solid, as you can see. At every vertex, you get two squares and two triangles.
And likewise for the other one.
What's the difference between that and what you just did before?
Oh, before I just took the midpoints of their faces and connected them. So there's six squares on the cube, but there's six vertices on the octahedron. So they nest. And likewise,
the octahedron has eight triangular faces, and the cube has eight vertices. So when you do this, you get the same thing. You don't get anything different. It's the same thing.
Oh, wow.
So we found one of the members of the family. The question is, the next question to raise is,
well, what will be the proportion of these edges to each other when this cube octahedron is the same? Same volume, same edge. Can anyone take a shot at that? Yeah, what if those two red cube octahedrons are the same volume and the same edges, what will be the ratio of the edges of the octahedron and the edge of the cube? What will be the ratio? Would you say, Pavel? Which one is one?
The
cube would be one, and this would be the square root of two. Because we can't get into it right now, but if you look at the relationship here, the edge of the cube is the diagonal of that square. And if this was 1, then this would be the square root of 2. But look at the relationship here. If you take a triangle and you connect their midpoints, you get another smaller triangle here, which is equal to the other triangles. They're all the same equilateral triangles. So if this were 1, then this would be 2. Or if this were a half, this would be... Anyway, you can figure it out. But the idea, this would, if this were 1, then that would be the square root of 2.
The edge. Which are incommensurable. Okay, so without going through the whole process by which I found the other guys, you'll notice that here's the case of the octahedron. Now, this, of course, is the end of the movement, where at the midpoints, you've got your cube octahedron. But look at the top here, this little pyramid. It starts to fill up as the corners are being pushed in. It's called a truncation, right? So, similar to an action on a monochord, where you can just go, here you've got a volume going, and just as on a monochord, you've got certain intervals, which create relationships to each other that are pleasant, not that one,
here, for example, at this point, through a constant truncation, you reach a point where the edge of a square is equal to the edge of an equilateral hexagon,
which is a point of congruence. Right?
Yeah.
So now the question is, what's the relationship of their volume? Right?
So you keep the truncation going, and then by the time it gets to here, it forms your next, forms the next congruence. But there's actually one between this one and that one,
which I'll show you. But you do the same thing for the cube. I've kept the colors the same, so you can see that their relationship to each other.
At the end, you reach the point where you get the cube octahedron. But at this one, when you're truncating the edges of the cube, you get these triangles. At this moment, you'll get equilateral triangles that share the same exact edge with equilateral octagons. That's another congruence.
The question is, what's the relationship of the volumes?
First, you've got to figure out what's the relationship of the edges. That's one thing. Because you can't take exactly a third of that, a third of the edge of the cube, and get that. It doesn't work that way.
The nature of the octagon and its the way you construct it will not... You can't exactly take thirds. Whereas in the octahedron, this other one...
This one is exactly a third of the edge of the octahedron.
So, I figured it out, and there's like, you can pass these around.
Oh, wow.
Careful with that one. This is one you've already seen already.
Before I pass it on.
Yeah, I know. Don't worry about it.
I did break it.
So the models I have, we can look at them afterwards, but they're all built to scale. They're all built to scale. You know, this is one. This is the square root of two.
Cool.
So that octahedron you're holding is a frame of the same edge of that. So you can see the actual relationship. The one that Kat's holding has a further truncation beyond that one.
It's somewhere between here and there. Yeah. It's somewhere between here and there. There's a new congruence there
that doesn't exist just through truncating the octahedron. You further have to truncate the thing that looks like the cube octahedron, which is in white, which is made up of kind of distorted hexagons and big squares. That produces what's called the rhombicube octahedron, which you'll see at every vertex has four squares and one triangle. So it's a truncation of a truncation, right? Similar to what you're dealing with on the monochord. You get these consonances, but from the consonances you get these melodic third intervals and other intervals which exist because of the consonances. And it's similar, right? You're taking truncations of truncation to get a congruence, as Kepler calls it. And there's geometrical ways to set up figuring that thing out, which we can't get into right now. But as you can see from all of them, the question that I raised was, well, what is the relationship of their volumes? Because they're all very unique in where they are. And you can actually figure out what their radius is to each other and find out what sphere they're in, and you can actually calculate. We did experiments where we actually built these wells.
Can you give me that? The model?
Like, pay no attention to the top one, but this bottom one would be a well, right? This one inside the cube, where you'd pour water in it, you'd create these wells made out of plexiglass. and you fill it with water and you pour, I wouldn't pour it six times, but I'd pour half. I'd pour three times, right? Because taking half of something, taking half of everything is like is the same as looking at their relationships as if they were all holes. So we performed this experiment, and I looked at the levels, but you still can't really get a sense of their intervals, their relationships, just by looking at the levels of the water. Still got to do more investigating. And Kepler says that the dodecahedric and icosahedric family is inexpressible in terms of their volume. The cube and the octahedric family is more expressible. So I haven't figured out why yet. The golden section probably will throws a little wrench in your calculation which is a whole other story. But you can pass these around. These are the calculations I made. By taking one of these, for example, the first one, you're looking at a octahedron. But what are the relationships of the volumes to the octahedron? And what you notice a lot of them correspond to musical intervals of the divisions of the string, consonances, and also the melodic and third intervals. The truncated octahedron, which is the one made up of hexagons and squares, is 8/9 of the octahedron. Exactly. Some of them aren't exact. And the cube octahedron and this one's interesting. The cube octahedron in this cube is 5/8 of the volume of the cube it's in, but it's 5/6 of the volume of the octahedron. So if this were the cube, this would be the octahedron. And if this were the octahedron, this would be the cube octahedron. So that's the thing, is that your whole string's going to change relative to the measurement. Right, because if this, you got to start with your whole. You start with your whole, and if it's 5/8, then you got to take 5/8 of the whole. But there are ways you can figure out what are all their relationships to each other. So that's one aspect of it. But revisiting this question of the doubling of the square and the cube. This is one example, physical example of doubling of the square, where you're simply dividing up the area, and you're just flipping it. Did everyone see that? And you're getting an area that's double. But what if we do that on the cube? If we take the area and do that, you're going to get something a little strange. But we're dealing with a cube, we're dealing with a body, and it has volume. So why don't we take an analogous approach to the cube as we did with the square, and divide its volume up and flip it out like this. So the well that I was describing, you take that and you just flip it inside out.
It's going to be a
Now you do that, there's going to be six of those parts. There's going to be six wells. Mm-hmm. Now what do you get when you plop it out? You will double the volume, but the question is, what type of shape will it create? Well, we got one of our faces right now. Seems to be on the same plane.
Oh.
I can't build the whole thing because I'm going to beat the clock here. It's all right if we go over, right? Yeah, Kepler actually discovered this. Original discovery of Kepler. No, he discovered the this yellow shape, gold shape. It's not Archimedean.
Kepler.
Yes.
That whole family will make the
shape. What's it? I'm going to show you why it's not Archimedean real quick. Why it's not Archimedean is because all of these vertices, this vertex here, that vertex, lie on two different spheres. In this solid form, they will not be on the same sphere. Whereas in an Archimedean, all the vertices lie on one sphere. So that's very interesting, the nature of that, because you're looking at two simply connected surfaces like a sphere, existing in this one shape.
So you're saying there's
as opposed to the other ones.
A smaller sphere around the cube and a larger sphere around the orange thing?
Mm-hmm. Right. They would have to be.
So there's a relationship between the two spheres.
Yeah. So the question is, what's that relationship, though? Well, there's two different spheres here, right?
Yeah.
There's one around the cube, and there's one around this thing out here. But what is that thing?
No.
Well, let's connect. These two are connected. If we connected these, our rhombus would have a major and minor axis. Right? It'd have a major and minor axis. The minor axis creating the edge of the cube. What's this thing creating? Well, there's four edges up here. There's four edges around here.
Every shape looks the same. The yellow,
yeah.
They all look the same. So what do you mean by minor?
Well, in an ellipse, you've got a major and minor axis, right? A minor axis, which is a small one, and a major axis, which is larger. Right, and the ellipse goes around, but it has two foci which are on the major axis.
Are you drawing a comparison?
I was just using it to describe it, but it's also interesting the fact that you have a solid body that requires two spheres to cover its vertices, yet the shapes that do make up have a major and minor axis, similar to an ellipse. Right. Not sure. I mean, we can get into that later. The point is that this thing doubles the cube.
Right?
But the whole Archytas problem though is to find another cube whose volume is double. Right. You don't see the cube, but you do see the doubled volume. Now go back to the musical. aspect of it, the intervals. The volume of this cube is 1. The volume of this rhomboid would be 2. What's the greatest interval you can make in terms of your octave? The octave, right? Now when you look on your paper, all the relationships among the family of these truncations exist between the boundaries of a process that doubles the cube. You didn't get it? All the volumes relationships exist. What's bounding it? What's bounding it is the octave. And you're looking at the octave. You don't hear it, but it's expressing itself. Now, when you view this from the standpoint of Archytas and the Archytas construction on the method of constructing a doubled square, this brings up an interesting point to the relationship of these musical intervals to these volumes and these shapes. Now, it might be difficult to grasp right now because you guys don't really fully grasp those constructions and how you go about finding them. But the idea is that the motion of the planets being elliptical is an expression of a certain type of a principle which is not seen in the ellipse itself. But even the ellipse itself is expressing something which is beyond it.
So what came first, the geometry or the
chicken or the egg? And we're going to... Yeah, we'll get into that question. Because the planets are not singing Yisumana for you, we do. What I meant by that was there's a creative aspect to the structure of the universe, which is not directly expressed, is not directly seen or heard, right, sensed, but it's there. So the Creator gave us these tones to create music.
Actually, that's what Kepler called for.
And that's what Megan's going to do.
Okay. So Kepler's discovery was quite a victory for mankind because he was the first person to take these relationships of the movement of the planets, which you guys probably have a sense from the new astronomy, are constantly changing at every moment during the orbit. And he was actually able to harness them and show something which was not only constant about them, but also comprehensible to the human mind. And actually, can you put that chart back up there? This one. Yeah, right. So this is the chart that Chris and Michelle were showing, where Kepler takes years and years of research into the Tycho Brahe's data, years and years of hypothesizing and discovering relationships between the distances and the motions. And what he discovers... I'm going to go back to it. What he discovers is that these these planets actually express intervals, the same kind of intervals which human beings use, find necessary for expressing ideas, which we'll get into. But something which I found very interesting, which we're sort of in the middle of figuring out, is that despite the fact that, you guys remember this relationship that Chris told you about? That the period of the entire orbit squared is equal to, in proportion, the distance cubed. But something which, just to kind of give you a sense of how amazing these harmonic relationships are, that's actually not true for the entire orbit. You actually get variations in the orbit. It's true of the entire period, and it's actually true of two particular moments in the orbit. But for the rest of the orbit, it's actually not quite true. It's not quite true in a knowable way. So what he was able to do is he was able to find, if you want to think of it this way, he discovered a stable platform for your mind to stand on to view the motions of the planets and their relationships, which is pretty amazing. And it's so stable that you can actually put it all on a string if you have a monochord big enough, which we're trying to think of how to make. Because you'd probably need like a 20-footer, I think, to do it. But yeah, we did this one night. We figured out given these relationships, if you take let's say that the magnitude of the motion of Saturn when it's its slowest, we'll call the entire string. You can call this motion. Okay, well, what's the relationship of Saturn's fastest motion to that? Well, Kepler demonstrates that it's a major third. So it's 4/5 of the string. So what we did is we lined this all up in the same string.
Oh.
And if you want a little zoomed in view of the it's messy, right? But take a look at Venus and how close Venus is. Okay, I still don't have a quote I wanted to read. Uh-oh. Hey, some of the images aren't up here. No, don't do it. That's fine. No. Huh? Well, actually, good one. Oh, okay. Okay. I want to go to... Okay. Next. Okay. Okay, so that's just another view of the same thing, where we expanded the bottom so it was visible. So what Kepler demonstrates is that if you were able to play all of these intervals, you would construct a scale. That the motions of all of the planets in our solar system actually account for all of the tones of a major and a minor scale. But it is funny, which I found interesting, and I'm trying to figure out why. You see these red notes with little question marks next to them? Well, if you begin with Saturn's aphelial motion as the entire string, all of the planets' motions fill up the entire scale except for the second note. There's no planet that actually sings that tone. And then, so what he does is he says, okay, well, we'll take the entire string as Saturn's quickest motion, and we'll tune from there. And what you find is that in relationship to Saturn's quickest motion, you actually have a planet, Mars, which sings that missing tone, except in this tuning, this particular tuning, you're lacking the next to the last note.
Wow.
However, with these two tunings, we can actually, our solar system sings all of the major and minor harmonies.
More about that. Yeah, I had a quote about that, but that's good. I mean, Kepler makes some comments, some pretty excited comment that God was so provident that he provided harmonies for each and every motion of our solar system. Okay, so this is pretty amazing because we don't have to worry about all this annoying change in the solar system. So things that you actually can't, like Vinny was bringing up how you constantly have these incommensurable relationships. Well, the whole orbit is incommensurable in a sense. So he actually found a solid place where we could stand where there's nothing variant, where it's perfect, or nearly. Because what you run into immediately, can somebody read this? Okay.
But among the extreme motions of the pairs of planets compared with each other.
You read it louder?
But among the extreme motions of the pairs of planets compared with each other, the clearest light is thrown at once as soon as we look at the heavenly harmonies. Whether you compare the receding extreme motions with each other, or the approaching, or between the approaching motions of Saturn and Jupiter, the proportion is exactly double, or a diapason, 1 to 2. Between their receding motions, it is a very little more than triple, 1 to 3. Between the diverging and converging motions of Jupiter and Mars reign the triple diapason.
That's a diapason is an octave.
Diapason. Triple diapason. 1 to 8. And the third, a double diapason above. 5 to 24. Though not perfectly. Lastly, the proportion allotted to Venus and Mercury are as the greatest, a double diapason. 1 to 4, and as the least, a hard 6, 3 to 5. Though these are not absolutely perfect, the planetary proportion is in excess by about 2/3 of a comma. That is 126 to 127.
Okay. So what's he talking about? He says that, well, these things are, you know, we have a perfect 1 to 2 relationship, nearly. We have a perfect, you know, between Mars and Jupiter, we have a perfect, you know, certain relationship, almost. So, what he's talking about is this. Now, for, I don't know if you guys see this, this is the same chart from before, but up there at the top next to Saturn perihelion, I wrote this proportion 53 to 54. Right? That's how much we would have to shorten our string by a proportion of 1/54th. In order for Saturn's perihelion to be perfectly in tune. We have to shorten Jupiter, the string of Jupiter's aphelion, by 1/55th of the string in order for Jupiter to be perfectly in tune. We would have to both lengthen and shorten the strings of Mercury by, I can't even read these numbers, but in order for Mercury to be in tune. And then you start to see that these things come up everywhere. So it raised a question in my mind. Okay, I mean, take, for example, Mars is off by 1/158th. That's how much you'd have to adjust the length of its string. But you start to think, well, if I'm adjusting every damned, you know, planet, how can we say that this thing's harmonic? And you have these cracks everywhere in the system. And so I was trying to think about this because in the New Astronomy, there's this very famous 8 minutes of an arc where you have a discrepancy between the hypothesis and the data, which Kepler sees it, his mind seizes on that, and he says that this indicates that there's something wrong with my hypothesis. But on the other hand, in other places, he would ignore discrepancies much larger than that and say that this is because of observational error.
I can attribute this to just error of the instruments or human error or the fact that it was really cold outside. So the question that is still in my mind and I want to raise to you guys is, are these errors because of errors in observation, or do they indicate a crack in the foundation of Kepler's hypothesis? So we're going to explore that a little bit. And we're going to explore it in a slightly different but related domain, which is music.
Mm-hmm. When you say, still fresh, when you say length of the string of bars,
mm-hmm. what do you mean? Well, if this whole string, the length of the string, was the magnitude of the slowest motion of Saturn. In proportion to that, the quickest motion of Saturn is this, which is 4/5 of the length of the other. And then Jupiter is this, the slowest motion of Jupiter. And you keep going, and you see why we would need a 20-foot monochord. So what you'd have to do, in other words, so the string of Jupiter is, like, that much too long. So we'd have to adjust it if we were going to be perfectly in tune. Okay, so I want to explore this question in the domain of music. And I want to ask you guys a question, which is, since we're Kepler claims that we're dealing with intervals in the motions. So I want to know what an interval is.
What does Kepler say? What does Kepler say?
Yeah. So he says that there are harmonic intervals existing amongst the motions of the planets, the extreme motions of the planets. So I'm asking what an interval is. A space between two points? Like two places?
Yeah.
Like two places on the map? Okay.
Well, it's only an interval in which you could have... it seems like with an interval you're denoting a relationship between two... Like, if you point at an interval, say the whole string and then half of it... Mm-hmm. You have the whole and then you have a half, the interval would be the relationship between the two, or it would be in between the two, the sound, the difference in pitch.
Okay, a relationship between two pitches.
Yeah, it seems like you have to have, well, yeah, it just seems like it comes out of two different pitches.
Well, what does the interval sound like? Can you hear it? If I play, I'll play Will's example. What did you hear?
You don't hear the interval.
You heard an octave?
Yeah.
How'd you hear that? I heard two tones.
Huh?
I heard two tones.
Can you do it again?
Yeah, I'll do it again. What can you hear? You can hear two tones, right? So where...
You hear two tones that are basically the same note.
They're basically the same note. Well, how do you figure that? What tells you that?
I don't know.
In other words, what's measuring the relationship? Is it your ears? Yeah, it's gotta be. Yeah. Well, this brings up an interesting question. If an interval, maybe we could say in first approximation that an interval is a relationship created in the mind amongst two sensible things, in this case, tones. So since we're dealing with music, I want to ask people, I want to ask people what a note is, but I mean more, like, where does a note come from? What produces a note? What?
A wave.
A wave.
Vibrating air.
Where does a note come from?
Yeah. Or what is a note? Motion.
The movement of voice. Collision of thoughts.
An idea.
An idea? Why an idea? Say that again?
You want to have an intention to produce a tone or a noise.
So I'm producing a note?
I'm producing many notes.
Okay, a person can produce a note.
If you were to take a specific tone, you would describe the quality of a note as an idea.
Okay. Yes.
In a person's voice, they differentiate between many tones. But if I were to continue to talk like this at one point, it's like things, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
One tone, one tone.
Well, I just want to get an idea of the different things that produce notes. We've already had a few. We've had people produce notes. The human voice, which is guided by a mind, produces notes. Things that wave there.
A string at a given length with a fixed tension.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Good. So keep those things in mind. Now I want to look at an example. I'm going to play something. Can you guys tell me what note that is?
C sharp.
No. Or how would you figure it out? If I played just one tone, if I just walked up to you and played or sang that.
You have to have another one.
You have to have another one?
Yes.
Okay. So you have to have something else to measure it with.
Do you
compare?
Well, how else? If I walked up to you and I sang a note to you, Aaron, or I played it on my monochord, how could you tell me which note it was? Okay. 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 I want to take this example of the F sharp and explore it for a second. Okay. Just to give you a sense of why this is maybe a more complex process that we're dealing with, F sharp is the name of a note that we sing often. now F sharp, let's say that our string, the whole length of our string is C, or do, and when I cut it in half, I get the octave above that. So this F sharp is an interesting creature because it, if we produce the creature that we'll name F sharp by taking the geometric mean between these two lengths of string, if my whole string was vibrating 256 times every second, which is a way to measure the vibration of a string, my F sharp would be vibrating 362 points, etc., times per second. Okay. Now, if I take a different action to produce this tone, and if instead of just taking the geometric mean between my two extremes, if I instead take a tone, which we call a fifth, which in this case would be G, and if I just go a half step down from G, then a perfect half step down from G, then my F sharp would be vibrating 360 times every second. Okay, well, there's another way you could do it, I could take the F of the scale and I could just go a half step, a perfect half step up instead. And if I do that, my F sharp is 364.0888 times every second. So the question arises, well, which is the real F sharp?
Oh, it's like it's creating a bell canto.
It's doing what?
It's like it's creating bell canto.
Why is it creating bell canto?
It's like it's finding different ways to arrive at something which will be harmonious.
Okay. Well, there are definitely different ways to arrive at something which is very close, because I bet you guys, if I played these three tones in a row, you couldn't tell the difference. I don't have it. I can do it. I can do it. We do have a Martha in here. Okay, the whole string. The first.
Do that again?
Okay.
Is C and F and G and C the same length?
No.
The C is 250. The C would be the whole string.
Okay. And the
looking at three quarters
is the geometric mean between the whole string and half the string.
The G down to F sharp is 360, so?
No. Yeah. Exactly. 360.
It's not in the
number. So the F up to F sharp is 364 and some extra. All right, so if we're going to get precise relationship, we actually have to, well, let me put it this way. You can see that depending on what's animating your tone, you generate slightly different relationships, depending on if you're coming from the bottom, from the top, or if you're taking an entirely different process, like taking the geometric mean. Did you have a question?
Was the first way you got it by taking the whole length dividing half, C to C?
The whole length divided in half.
Is 362?
No, well, no. The whole length divided in half gives you the octave, and then if I take the geometric mean between the two of those, like if I said that this is a length of 1 and this is a length of 2, this would be a length of the square root of 2.
Okay. Then that gives
362.3. Yep. Okay. Depending on what is organizing the tones, we tend to get slightly different relationships. And this is kind of normal, because if you think about humans, you kind of operate the same way, because human beings aren't just floating out there in empty space by themselves, but you're part of a society. And you have relationships to other people, you have relationships to other minds, people like Lynn, people that are dead, people like Socrates. You also have relationships to principles, like principles of statecraft, principles in our constitution. And you know, you are sort of defined by certain relationships that organize you. So a note is kind of the same way, because notes just don't exist in empty space, but they exist as parts of systems. You know, you could call it a scale if you wanted. People are pretty familiar with the major scale. Which is, you know, you could also call it modes, different ways of getting around, which are a certain organization of different relationships. So let's, to get at that, actually, let's keep on the trail of the F sharp. And I want to sing two of these, just two of these different modes. Okay, I want to sing a major scale two times, but we're going to start on a different note. The first one, we're going to start on a D, so it'll sound like this. And in the course of this, you'll sing an F sharp. Why don't we sing on solfege? so you guys know where you are. Greg, ready? It was the fifth note you sang, right?
Yeah.
You're kind of right in the middle of things. So let's do it again. Let's do it coming down. And let's do it from the bottom again. One more time. Ready?
No. I want to look specifically at a piece of music by Mozart, just briefly. I just want to look at it briefly, because he also takes up this creature, the F sharp, and he treats it in a couple different ways. So, first, I want to play something, and people probably recognize it. Recognize that? Yeah.
Yeah. Musical offering by Bob. Bye. Right, bye. Why don't people just sing it on no? Ready? Go. Took up a continuation of a certain idea from Bach. And he did something which I find very interesting. He did this. Actually, Chris, can you put the PDF file up? The music. Okay, can you zoom in on just the first 2 minutes?
Yeah, sure.
That's good. Yeah, so there's your F sharp. Third note, where Bach left it out. Yeah, I'll play it again. I'm not going to claim to have cracked this piece. But I just want to explore just a little tiny piece of it, part of it. And we're going to, I want you guys to sing it. And we'll get to that, how we're going to do that. But first, actually, Mom, can you play just the first two measures so people get a sense of it? And he continues. Okay, listen carefully. Can you go to the next page, though?
Next page?
The next page, yeah. Yeah, the next page on there. Uh-huh. No. No. Okay, stop. We only need like the top, yeah, that section.
A section there?
The top section.
Under here?
Yep. Okay. So I'm going to have Miles play just like 8 measures of this. Just listen carefully. What's interesting is that you can see just by looking at the score that this F sharp is everywhere. It's the first note that the soprano voice sings. It's here, it's here, it's in here, and it's all over. But there was some change that was that you could hear in there, so I want to explore it a little bit by singing it, having you guys sing it, because Mozart composed this as a chorus, as voices. Okay, could I skip the piano for a minute?
Yeah, so, you study it?
Maybe later. Okay, so, we have the sopranos on no or new if you want the first note. Sing this. All the sopranos. Ready? Go. Yeah, exactly. Now, I want the basses to sing this. Until here. So the basses are going to go, and then you do this.
Okay, let's try it on. No, so I'll put a bass line and you respond.
Thank you.
Okay. Ready? Hands.
No.
Yeah, just try that last part. starting from right there. Ready? Go. Good. Try it with the sopranos. So, as you know, altos, sopranos. Ready? Go. Sing it where you can. Sing where you can. Okay, let's try it again. Ready? Go. Who sings soprano?
Alright,
let's have all the sopranos one more time. Okay. Who's singing soprano?
I am.
Is Alicia? Emma?
I was singing also, but I can sing soprano.
Okay.
Maggie.
We have two sopranos?
Maggie.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
Thank you.
Ready? Go.
No.
Just so you guys, I just want you guys to be able to hear all of these six measures, and we can't sing it, but just, yeah, just try to think about how you would decide how to intone these notes. I was talking to John Segerson about this today, and he said, well, if you were actually singing this, you may want to change the vowel.
on those three notes. We want to actually decide to go from a knee to a no on those notes. Which would, you know, maybe you could call it a change in pitch, but it almost seems more like a change in the color of the note. So just to kind of finish up here, you have an interesting phenomenon in the domain of music where these changes are actually become necessary for the creation of music in the mind of another person, from the composer to the performer, and then to the audience member. So reflecting back on these commas that arose in the solar system, okay, you could look at them as mistakes or cracks in the foundation of Kepler's hypothesis, but the way I'm trying to think about it is, well, maybe the fact that, as Kepler said, man found pleasure in the same harmonic intervals that God used to knit the universe together. Perhaps the fact that man found these commas and these changes necessary for the communication of profound ideas indicates something about the God that we're imitating and the way in which he is composing his universe. So I just want to finish up with a quote about that. I'm just going to look at that. Yeah. That's it. The last slide. Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. Can somebody read this? Oh wait, it's not up yet. When we get to it. There they are. Okay. Could somebody read this, please?
Yeah, I'll read it.
Okay.
Therefore, the motions of the heavens are nothing but a kind of perennial harmony in thought, not in sound, but through dissonant tunes, like certain syncopations or cadences by which men imitate those natural dissonances, and tending towards definite and prescribed resolutions, individual to the six terms as with vocal parts, and marking and distinguishing by those notes the immensity of time. Thus it is no longer surprising that man, imitating his creator, has at last found a method of singing in harmony which was unknown to the ancients, so that he might play, that is to say, the perpetuity of the whole of cosmic time, in so
brief
fraction of an hour, by the artificial concert of several voices and taste, up to a point the satisfaction of God his maker in his works, by a most delightful sense of pleasure felt in this imitator of God, music.
Somehow he uses the term artificial.
I'm going to need my computer screen here.
All right.
What? No, unfortunately, I didn't have enough time. Okay. So in the process of trying to look at what Kepler does in Book 5, we've all struggled a great deal. Because, like Michelle was saying, and Chris at the beginning, in the New Astronomy, Kepler goes through his entire hypothesis, his whole process of hypothesis. And he kind of leads you with him through an entire array of different ideas that he has as he develops his final conception, or it's not really his final conception, but as he leads you through his discovery, right? In the Harmony of the World is not like that at all. It's just not like that at all. And what's really interesting about it is that you find, or at least I found myself, very uncomfortable with certain aspects of it. And anyone who's read it will probably agree that there's certain aspects of it which are very difficult. And what I found myself thinking about a lot was a really large question. What really is the nature of the relationship between God and a finite and created world? In other words, what's the relationship between the infinite and eternal and the finite, temporal? Or conversely, just in case you misunderstand me, what's the difference of a God who doesn't exist anywhere and is not in time to a world which we experience as both spatial and temporal? And then you wonder, what's the relationship of man to that relationship? And I found myself actually hunting around outside of Kepler. And in fact, one thing that we had to do was go outside of the Harmony of the World and look at many of Kepler's other works. Some of us have looked at Nicholas of Cusa a great deal. We've had to sort of build up an entire process of historical developments around Kepler's idea. And so I found myself going to Schiller, which sounds kind of funny, right? Because Schiller is someone who didn't write about science too much, exactly. I mean, he mentions it, but you wouldn't think of Schiller as a scientist in the same way that you would Kepler, right? So this is a quote that stood out to me. It's in letter 25 of the Aesthetic Letters on the Education of Man. As long as man derives sensations from a contact with nature, he is her slave. But as soon as he begins to reflect upon her objects and laws, he becomes her lawgiver. Nature, which previously ruled him as a power, now expands before him as an object. What is objective to him can have no power over him, for in order to become objective, it has had to experience his own power. As far and as long as he impresses a form upon matter, he cannot be injured by its effect. For a spirit can only be injured by that which deprives it of its freedom. Whereas he proves his own freedom by giving a form to the formless. Where the mass rules heavily and without shape, and his undefined outlines are forever fluctuating between uncertain boundaries, fear takes up its abode. But man rises above any natural terror as soon as he knows how to mold it and transform it into an object of his art. As soon as he upholds his independence towards phenomenal natures, he maintains his dignity toward her as a thing of power, and with a noble freedom, he rises against his gods. They throw aside the mask with which they had kept him in awe during his infancy, and to his surprise, his mind perceives the reflection of his own image. The divine monster of the Oriental, which roams about changing the world with the blind force of a beast of prey, dwindles to the charming outline of humanity in Greek fable. The empire of the Titans is crushed, and boundless force is tamed by infinite form. Yeah, it's letter 25. You gotta read them all. You can't stop it wherever usually people stop. Lainey thinks it's letter 9. So in this question, I realized that part of what you look at in this development of hypothesis and what Schiller is referring to here is really a hypothesis about our relationship to God and to the universe as a whole, which is a changing hypothesis. And in embroiled with that is a question about time. So I was going to, I realize that I'm have a time limitation here because of the B bar, and they're exerting a certain pressure from beneath. So I was going to go through something which I found, it's kind of interesting. You think that certain things should be very, very clear. As we've been working through this and diving into the new astronomy, and we've expended so much time in the animations group on the harmony of the world. So something like the periods of a planet. How do you actually determine how long the orbit of another planet is? Now, Jason Ross has a pedagogical, it's like the second pedagogical on the animation site. But a certain really curious anomaly arose when I started to really try to think about it and play with it, which is if a planet is going almost as fast as you are, but not quite, you could wait a very, 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 very long time before you came back into opposition with that planet. Meaning at the point where the sun was on one side of you and the planet was on the other, if that planet were traveling just a little bit slower than you were, as you go around the track, so to speak, that planet is always going to be trailing you by just, you know, a little bit more. It's going to increase slightly over time, right? But that the length of time before you reach that planet again could be very, very long. So in that relationship, how do you actually determine what its orbital period is? I have another question. How did Ptolemy determine the orbital period of a planet? If the Earth is at the center of the whole universe, then how do you know? I mean, if you look at section 1 of the new astronomy, you have to wonder. I mean, you look at the pretzel that he draws out, right? This is the pretzel of Mars. This is what Ptolemy actually thinks Mars is doing. So then the question is, well, how do you unravel that into anything intelligible at all? Now, Ptolemy did in a certain way. Another interesting question, which comes up directly from this, is how do you determine what the relative distance of a planet is? Now, this is something that plays a very key part in what Kepler did. And the entire foundation of the Mysterium Cosmographicum is based on that, as Michelle and Chris went through in the beginning. This was something that was almost entirely impossible for Ptolemy to do. This was part of why Copernicus's system was sort of used to a certain degree, even though the idea of it having some physical connection to reality was eradicated by this letter that this man named Osiander put at the front of it. And you find Copernicus as well is very, very, as I've been looking through it, I mean, he's always very funny about it. I mean, he always says, well, the sun is motionless at the center, and the centers of the orbits of the planets are around the sun. And he says that over and over and over again. The centers of their orbits are around the sun. They're not on the sun, right? And there's certain things that he holds on to very, very strongly.
he holds on to this idea of the perfect circle against all else. And he finds himself using some of the different things that Ptolemy had to use to be able to maintain those circles. But I ask the question, what is the real difference between Copernicus and Kepler? Copernicus' system enabled us to do things that we had never been able to do before. And if you look at Kepler and you read the New Astronomy, you might become fairly enraged with him. I mean, particularly on certain questions like the question of time. And this came up with us as well. Because if you're dealing with a solar system which is always changing, this question of time seems like it's kind of important. Like, how do you measure time? I'll throw out another paradox that I was going to expend a little bit more time on, but if you notice, if you go outside tonight and you look at your watch and you look at where a very distinct star is at a particular moment by your watch, you'll find that when you go out the next night and you look at that same star, it's not going to be in exactly the same place at the same time. You'll find that there's actually a difference between the time it takes for you to come back to that star and the time it takes you to come back to the sun. Now, I ask you why, but I also ask, which is right? Is your watch right, or is the star right? So, in looking at the question of something like the difference between Copernicus and Kepler, and again, like I was saying, you might become kind of enraged with Kepler. He changes his measurement of time in the New Astronomy, I don't know how many times, right? I mean, it's the mean anomaly, right? It's the equant. It's not the equant. It's the eccentric. It has a relationship to the equating anomaly. At one point, it's actually at the center of the orbit. It's the area, right? So you have, and an area which he measures as minutes and seconds, which is a sort of a funny thing too, right? So you have this changing conception, and it's sort of a funny thing. Because you also look at the time in which Kepler lived and his idea about what he was doing. Copernicus held fast to the idea of the circle. Kepler held fast to the idea of harmony in the universe. In 1599, he wrote a letter to his teacher, Maestlin, who, by the way, wrote an epitome of astronomy which adhered to Ptolemy's system. Even though he had taught Kepler Copernicus's system in the 1590s, he writes and Maestlin adhered to that even in 1624. He published another version after Kepler had made all of his discoveries. All of his, so-called three planet laws, Maestlin still adhered to the Ptolemaic system in public till the end of his life, despite everything, right? But in 1599, Kepler wrote Maestlin a letter where he said, I have a conception for a book. It's going to be five parts, and I'm going to call it The Harmony of the World. So it took Kepler 19 years to write that book. Now, I wanted to read you. I can't, it won't, yeah, I don't have it ready to go. Okay. This is something that Lynn said in response to a question yesterday. Look, those of us who have fought as I have fought, we don't give up. We're right. We know we're right. We keep at it. And we wait for the time that comes when what we're proposing will be accepted. And if it takes time, that's all right. Because what can we do about it?
There's nothing we can do about it. You can't artificially change history. You provide ideas. Some ideas will creep ahead independently and you of you and go forward. But at the same time, you know that you're coming to a point where decisions are going to have to be made. You base yourself on preparing yourself and others for that decision, which is the only solution. The problem is the nervous Nelly, the coward in warfare. The nervous Nelly says, "We're losing the war. We got to make a deal with the enemy now." The coward. And therefore, if you're not a coward and you have the right policy, stick to it. If you don't win right away, stick to it, because it's the right policy. That's the only way to look at it. So, let's see. Well, here, actually, this is the right one. Okay, this is famous. We have it up on our website. Mm-hmm. Now, 18 months after the first light, 3 months after the true day, but a very few days after the pure sun of that most wonderful study began to shine, nothing restrains me. It is my pleasure to yield to the inspired frenzy. It is my pleasure to taunt mortal men with the candid acknowledgement that I am stealing the golden vessels of the Egyptians to build a tabernacle to my God from them, far, far away from the boundaries of Egypt. If you forgive me, I shall rejoice. If you are enraged with me, I shall bear it. See, I cast the die and I write the book. Whether it is to be read by people of the present or the future makes no difference. Let it await its reader for 100 years, if God himself has stood ready for 6,000 years for one to study him. So, what was going on for Kepler when he wrote this was his mother was being tried as a witch, for which it was very likely she was going to be tortured. His child had just died, and he was in the process of a very long fight with the people who ran the university he attended, including Maeslin, who stayed in the background, never said anything publicly, but he was in a fight with them over the communion. Now, of course, this doesn't have a lot of meaning for us, but for Kepler, it had a great deal of meaning. The fact that he was being rejected from the communion with his Lutheran brethren because of something that would seem completely insane to us today, or at least it seems insane to me. I mean, it's on a question of the transubstantiation of the communion, right? The transubstantiation of Christ when you eat the wafer. Is the body of Christ actually everywhere at once? Or is it, you know, somehow transformed when it touches your mouth? Like, over this question, Kepler, who had come out publicly and had said what he actually believed in an attempt to reunify the churches, really to have some understanding, at least between the Lutherans and the Calvinists, at the very least, that they completely rejected him. And this is a person who had been in the employ of a Catholic emperor, and had always rejected the attempts for them to have him become a Catholic. So Kepler ended up standing completely alone. And this is all happening right at this moment in this incredibly turbulent war. I mean, this incredibly turbulent world. Because what I would also point out is that in May of 1618, there was an event that's called the Defenestration of Prague, and suddenly, you have the 30 Years' War. So all of these events, which would make me shudder, were occurring at the same time. And what does Kepler do? He proclaims against all earthly evidence that the world is harmonic. And that God loves man so much that he made us in his image that we could discover that harmony. So, I actually had a, well, yeah. I want to just read one more. I know this is dangerous. I'm reading a lot of quotes. Everybody's getting tired and sleepy. No? No? All right, everyone's woken up. Okay, well, the bee bar is going, so soon you really will. So, what I would say is that the nature of time changes with the relationship of man to the universe. And that the art of hypothesizing is part of that process of change, of the nature of time. And the areas, the sections of this book that are most difficult for us to grapple with, like section 4, which starts off just so lovely. You know, Kepler has this great quote. I'm going to read this to you. You're going to get really excited. And then he has this great quote from Proclus that goes on for pages, which is awesome. And you're like, wow, this is great. And then all of a sudden, he starts to go into the astronomical, the astrological aspects of the relationship of the world's soul and the unborn fetuses to the stars and the angles they, the apparent angles they make from the Earth, right? Now this is, and this is actually something I'll say in respect to his other hypothesizing as well. I mean, in the harmony in book 5, where all of the things that other people had gone through, Kepler chooses not the true motion of the planet, but the apparent motion from the sun. Not how fast the planet is really truly going, as Kepler makes very clear, but the apparent motion as some mind would see on the sun.
Like zodiacal.
Yeah, zodiacal from the sun, right? So the arc length that the planet would travel in a given day, as seen from the sun, would show you how fast that planet was going with respect to the sun. Now, one thing about the sun is that you wouldn't have retrogradations, right? But the planet would be changing its distance from the sun, which actually would change your perception of how fast or slow it was going. Now, the sun is the mover, right? According to Kepler, where the sun has a privileged position in the solar system. But a mind on the sun? I mean, whose mind? I mean, we had the joke about George Bush, right? It's certainly not one of us. So then you have a very odd question. You have an odd question in the fact that Kepler will, in the midst of these hypotheses, he says these amazingly insightful things. I mean, he was very clear. There's a number of even Casper, who loved Kepler, and says that his, you know, and obviously worked through everything that Kepler ever wrote in Latin and German, and dedicated his entire life to the man. But Casper, even he, who is definitely a scholar, as you become aware, as you read him, Hughes says, well, there is one thing about Kepler. I mean, Newton really did discover gravity because Kepler didn't understand Galileo's concept of inertia. But then, within another page, Casper's telling you about how Kepler dedicated an entire chapter of the New Astronomy to the question of inertia, or to the relationship of the body's mass itself. I mean, as Michelle pointed out, the planets going around the sun in an Aristotelian system, they might as well be empty points of light or empty objects, empty spaces. For Kepler, they were bodies. They had mass. They had volume. They had a relationship with the sun. The part of what was causing the changing of the speed was the influence of the planet, which Kepler is very clear about in both the New Astronomy and also in the Harmony of the World. So this idea, so even Casper doesn't fully recognize or is blind to some of the amazing insight that Kepler actually had. But at the same time, and you can say, and Casper actually, you know, rails against people for this, but at the same time, one of the things that modern, if you go on the internet, you go on Wikipedia or something, right, they'll say, well, the problem is that Kepler's really just a mystic. He's really just, you know, kind of crazy. I mean, this whole harmony thing, the whole idea of music and spheres, I mean, it's a nice idea. He took it from Ptolemy, but it's really not science, right? And yet somehow he came up with these amazing ideas. Well, here it is. It's 10 o'clock, man, right on the dot. Okay.
Breach of contract right there.
All right, well, I'm gonna give a little bit more. All right, so remember what I was saying about the question, the relationship of hypothesizing and our relationship to time. Okay. This is, Kepler's now going through the different ancient ideas about harmony. He's already given his own, which I was going to read to you, but this is more important, okay? He says, now Plato's view on mathematical things was that the human mind is in itself thoroughly informed on species or figures and axioms and conclusions about things. However, when it seems to learn, it is merely being reminded by sensible diagrams of those things which it knows on its own account. He conveys that with singular ingenuity in the dialogues by introducing a slave who, when questioned by his master, makes all the replies as desired. Aristotle, on the contrary, in his Metaphysics, calls this a fabrication, a, quote, fictitious argument twisted to fit the hypothesis. As neither do these mathematicals ever exist independently of sensible things, nor is their character, even in the mind, on any different basis from that on which other universals are in the mind, as a species of the actual essence of individual sensible things is formed in the mind by definition. Thus, they are indeed prior to sensible things and abstracted from sensible things, yet not in reality, but in mental conception. Hence, it should be noticed that Aristotle, almost every time he happens to name any one of the mathematical categories by way of example, always names either a point or a line or a surface or a body or a number, which are the chief categories of which quantity is predicated. But mention is very rarely made throughout these treatises, indeed, of quantities insofar as they are shapes, and in the fourth species of quality, where their material aspect, quantity, is one thing, but their formal aspect, shape, another. And insofar as they are relations, absolutely no mention at all. Indeed, he even proposes harmonic knowledge for investigation with reference to nothing except voices, and to them solely insofar as they are lines, meaning parts of a string. Exactly as in the optics. However, of the interval between the different parts, which are a proportion, a relation, of course, and that indeed of quality and shape, Aristotle never even dreams. So, there's, here, okay. Oh, shoot. I don't know if I've got that other one. Okay. Anyway, he goes on to talk about the fact that as Aristotle doesn't actually believe that there's anything in the mind. It's a blank slate, right? And essentially that the only way that you can know anything is as a, it's sort of something that comes as a super product of sensible things. So it sort of emanates out of sensible things. meaning that the mind has no actual, really has no ontological quality about it. The mind itself, in that respect, if all it is the thing that impresses these emanations from sensible things, is really just a product of the sensible things itself, and therefore has no immortal existence. It doesn't really exist. It's transitory.
So what organizes those things?
Well, that's a good question, right? That's something that we can... Yeah.
Okay, alright. So I have this really, really big sort of idea, complex thing in my own little hypothesis and theory that I would like to show everyone, that's only if you allow me to.
Okay, yeah. You know, we should. I just, let me try to wrap up because I'm already trying to beat the clock here. Beat the B bar. Okay. So I'm actually gonna finish up, but I mean I know I put forward a lot. The real questions that we're grappling with are actually no less. I mean, it's sort of funny when I was talking to Peter, my friend back in Seattle, about what we're trying to do, and I was saying, you know, the problem is I just don't feel like I have enough time. And he laughed at me. He's like, "What do you mean? What do you guys do with the animations anyway?" You know. And I was like, "Well, it's sort of funny, but I mean, there's just so much, and the more that I do, the more I feel like I need to do, the more there is that I need to look into." And he said, "Well, you know, it's interesting. I've just been reading the letters of Kepler, and he always talks about the fact that he doesn't have enough time, that everything is just pressing in on him all the time, right?" And I just gave you a sense of maybe why that would be in Kepler's case. But again, I mean, not to say that we can, you can't really make a precise comparison in this way, but we're also in a very turbulent time in history. And in another sense, you look at what Kepler was able to produce at those most turbulent moments. It's fairly phenomenal, right? So, Peter also pointed out to me that Gauss often also says that he doesn't have enough time. And I don't know about Leibniz, I've never found that, but Gauss said that Leibniz didn't have enough time. So, you know, there's lots of questions about that, right? And Peter said, well, maybe what you're actually struggling with is the relationship between the immortal and the mortal, the finite and the infinite, right? That you have this longing for the infinite, but you have an awareness of your temporal finitude. So, from that standpoint, I wanted to... Okay, so I want to end with just these three quotes from Kepler, just to kind of give you a sense of the mind at hypothesis, and then maybe if we're not totally bumped out of here, we can have some questions, because I know people have a lot. Okay. This is something he wrote, I think, in about 1604. So, right around the time that he was composing the New Astronomy. It's in one of his calendars. Which, by the way, are in German, and they're written for the common people, which is sort of an interesting question about Kepler's organizing... which he was very aware that that's what he was doing. I may say with truth that whenever I consider in my thoughts the beautiful order, how one thing issues out of and is derived from another, then it is as though I had read a divine text written into the world itself, not with letters, but rather with essential objects, saying, "Man, stretch thy reason hither, so that thou mayest comprehend these things." Okay. This was in the reply to Maeslin, who really got nastier and nastier as Kepler got more and more famous. And Kepler is really interesting in that he really maintained a loving relationship with him, and he defended Tycho Brahe all the way to the end, despite everything. Which, you know, you can read it yourself and find out more. But so Maeslin has, you know, kind of basically said, well, you know, you probably don't have time for me anymore now that you're so important and big. And so Kepler answers, high honors and offices I do not have. I live here on the stage of the world as a simple private man. If I can squeeze out a portion of my salary at the court, I am happy not to have to live entirely on my own means. As for the rest, I take the attitude that I serve not the emperor, but rather the whole human race and posterity. In this confident hope, I scorn with secret pride all honors and offices, and, in addition, if it is necessary, also those things which they bestow. I count as the only honor the fact that by divine decree I have been put near the Tychonic observations. There's an irony there as well, right? Considering the quote that Michelle read, it's an interesting. Now, and this one is, this one's sort of funny too. This is in a letter that he wrote to a good friend of his at a point, which is also really sad in his life. His first wife has died a year after one of their children, who they really love, who was 6 years old and looked like he was going to live. I mean, Kepler lost more children than most people have. And so, I mean, he lost a lot. And he was in the process of trying to find another wife, which is sort of a funny thing. And he said, and he just got very befuddled by the whole thing. So he wrote this to his friend. There is nothing which I desired more to investigate thoroughly and to know than this. Can I also find God within myself, God whom I readily grasp when contemplating the universe? There's one thing I wanted to propose. I know that some people have read the Harmony of the World, and I didn't check this out with the War Room at all. I don't know if it would work, but if there were people who had read it and they wanted to work with us on it tomorrow and see if you had questions and whatnot, because I know people who have maybe do, and we have spent a lot of time on it to maybe be able to help out when you go back to your respective locals. So maybe we could take time to work on it tomorrow, after we meet with Lynn. I'm not sure. But if people would want to do that, we can, perhaps, depending on the War Room, I guess.
Is there a schedule for tomorrow?
We need to figure out the time. So yeah. The only schedule is meet with Lynn.
Okay.
I think, are you guys done? I don't know what's
good. Yeah.
Okay.
I meant to end there. I don't know if everybody.
Yeah,
we want, I mean, it's not too bad, and there's a lot of us here, so.
And we're also going to have the West Coast one, so we should be there on time. And I think I'll get more clarity into particulars, but I mean, that's what we know. It's going to be at the Hampton Inn in Leesburg, Virginia, which is like 10 minutes away from the office in Virginia. I printed up some scripts and maps, so I have that. So we should be here at 9. so people don't show up. So I think it would be good to show up together versus in just like trickle in style. But well, LaRouche is going to give a briefing. But I mean, that's it now. I'm going to get the details, more details tonight.
Is it here?
You're handling car arrangements?
These persons?
No. Every car, you said, you're responsible for all this.
So the advanced off trucks deployment, get the cars.
Are we supposed to be to the hotel until when?
That's what we have to figure out.
And how about everybody get in the car?
Go ahead.
Okay. I don't want to be here all night.
So pretty much all night it seems like we've been talking about, you know, relationships. And all right, so here, just sit there.
You got a rag here. Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. I'm gonna get on the other side of here. That's okay. I'm gonna move on to the other side.
So, when we think of a relationship, right? A relationship is like two, right? You know, number two, because one, you know, you need two, in order to form a relationship, you need two things, right? Right? Correct?
At least.
Right? So what is a relationship, right? Alright, so here we have this. Right, you have a relationship, okay? Okay. Okay. And then, alright, so pretty much, and then we talk about ideas. So, alright, so one. Here we have one idea. And then, in order to form a relationship, we added a second idea. But when we add these two ideas, I mean, but if we add these two ideas, it goes. That forms three, and you know, three is like pretty much. So this relationship, as I was saying earlier, this relationships. Allow change. And change really is motion, right? If you think about it. And as I was saying earlier, if life cannot come from, you know, living things, if life can't come from non-living things, then it can only come from life, right? So, and what causes life is change, because it allows us to build, you know, these, you know, the relationship. It allows us to create more relationships, and a relationship is two, so therefore, is four, which that led me to like doubling the square. Right? Okay. So now, three I said was, you know, sort of like, because if we sort of accept, you know, this one idea, then it sort of becomes, you know, if we have these two ideas, and then, you know, like, well, and then we decide we accept this one idea, then it sort of becomes, you know, perfection, and but then we're, it's like acceptance, and this acceptance, well, that sort of acceptance brings us to zero, nothing, death. You know, it leads us to chaos, right? It leads us to chaos. This, you know, non-uniformity, but with this non-uniformity and this whole non-uniformity, this sort of, I mean, like, because, and then, like, by change, I mean, this is like, and then that, this is like harmony, and that's why it works, because I don't know if that makes sense, but if this is kind of making sense, but what? But
I think you're on to
something. But I mean, because this, because you know, I mean, you know, with reductionism, I mean, we're going this, you know, sort of in this direction. You know.
Have you read in Nicholas of Cusa?
Yeah, that's where I kind of got this idea from. And, you know. And this is sort of, I mean, like, and this is like the minimum maximum principle because, like, you know, we have infinity, we have, well, this, well, we have, like, not necessarily infinity, but, like, I don't know. Sort, well, I don't know. But we have, it just, I don't know, it just brings us, somehow that brings us to nothing, you know, I mean, to this, because it kills the ideas, it stops, I mean, for example, I mean, like, you know, one person gives one idea, right, and then the other person gives another idea, but then once you accept that idea, then that's the end of thought, there's no more, you know, so you can't continue, you can't go on, you can't go any further, so it just stops.
More ideas.
Yeah, which is why we need relationships. And that's what we've been doing, is, you know, trying to find relationships, which leads us, brings us to four. And that, and because we have, you know, this doubling allows us to have three, these inequalities, this non-uniformity.
There's a section in the harmony of the world that you're really going to like. It's on its attack.
Yeah.
You're
gonna
dig
it a lot.
It's
in book one. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. See, what's interesting, there's a quote I didn't use where Lynn actually talks about Nicholas of Cusa in a paper that he wrote called I Don't Believe in Science. You remember that one? With Charles Babbage?
Yeah.
And he says Cusa is very awkward because it's a new idea. It's a revolutionary idea. And when you try to come up with a new language for a new discovery, there's no concepts that have been formed yet, it's awkward. And it seems that maybe that's where you are, is you're forming a hypothesis and it has a certain awkwardness to it.
Yeah, well,
you haven't thought it all the way through yet.
No, but that non-uniformity, you know, I mean, we're saying, you know, like, I don't know, like, I remember in a meeting, like, in Boston, we were talking about, you know, non-uniformity and uniformity, and, you know, how pretty much, like, I don't know, like, it was, like, Gauss or, you know, well, actually, like, Riemann, he was, you know, pretty much, he was trying to figure out why these non-uniformities were uniform. And this is why it's uniform, because, I don't know,
yeah.
You know what I mean? But yeah, that's all.
All right. Did you other people
taking off?
B-Boy's taking over people. All right.
Oh my God.